welcome to another edition of Film Grok. Today we're going to be looking at the 1982 theatrical release of Blade Runner, the science fiction classic. My name is Serge Delpierre. To my right,
John H. Ruby.
To my left,
Tim McMillan.
To his left,
Curtis Nelson.
Welcome all. Thank you for coming.
It's good to be here.
Yes. Anyway, briefly, my experience with this is I saw this in 1982. I went one summer day in that same summer where we had Poltergeist, E.T., and yes, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Nice.
That's another story. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and I went and saw this movie with my friend John and blown away, completely blown away, so much that I had to go back the next day and see it again, which,
nice.
And this is the days, you know, when like video was just starting, and this wouldn't come out on video for a couple of years, so that was definitely a big thing.
It was deterioration of beta, actually, probably.
Beta was still around then, still for a few years. So, John, what's your experience with Blade Runner?
I saw Blade Runner, I'm not sure, I don't think I saw it in the theater, but I did see it with this, the theatrical version with the voiceover, so maybe I did see it in the theater way back when. But I also saw recently the final cut version, so we can also, you know, go back and forth the differences and similarities during it. But where I'm really going to approach this from is the whole screenplay writing point of view and how Blade Runner uses the structure and also does a couple things differently, but everything's there, and they use it to support the story they want to tell, which and I love it. I'm a big science fiction fan, so anytime you want to do Wrath of Khan or anything else, we're I'm in on it.
Oh, that's a discussion. And John, as always, you have a website, right?
Sure. StructureNotFormula.com. And it's all about screenplay structure. And it's all about, really quickly, when you guys see a car, right? You don't walk up to a car and go, oh, my God, it's got four wheels and doors. How uncreative. No, that's the structure of the car. But then once you got that structure, you can do whatever you want. Convertible, SUV, hybrid, blah, blah, blah. And so that's where I approach a lot of people. As soon as I say structure, they get all, oh, I don't want to write formula and blah, blah, blah. It's not about that. It's about how can structure support the story you want to tell. So that's where I'm coming from.
Oh, and I will definitely try and get you on those. Well, not get you, I mean, because I think it's always intriguing. It's like, okay, this fits in here. It's very interesting. Yeah. Tim, Blade Runner?
Well, I think you guys might hate me, but I never saw this filmed until 1992 when the director's cut was re-released theatrically. Before that, bits and pieces on video, and I never even saw the entire film in one sitting. I saw that re-release, and then the next time I watched it was just recently with the restoration that just came out, which is called the Ultimate Cut, correct?
Final Cut.
Oh, that's the final cut?
That's final cut.
So the director's cut is known as?
Director's cut. And then, well, there was theatrical cut. There was U.S. theatrical cut, which was what went on video shortly thereafter. Then in 92, there was director's cut.
Okay.
Which Ridley Scott really didn't have.
He had some to do with it, but not a lot with it. And we'll get into a bit where that came from. And then in 2007, final came out, which is where Ridley Scott was involved. And said, yes, this has my stamp of approval.
And I saw the re-release of the final cut with Curtis.
Yes, we did.
Sweet.
Nice.
So this will be interesting for you because you've never seen this version.
That's absolutely right. Wow. I've never seen this version that we're about
to unfurl. And this, for me, is the version. This is what I grew up with. I'm like, this is Blade Runner to me.
Capital so when I saw T-H-E, the version.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So director's cut for me was quite an experience. Curtis?
Well, my experience with it was I was a child of the 80s. I was born in 72. I was only 10 when it came out, and my parents certainly didn't take me to the theaters to see it. But being a child of the 80s and growing up in Oklahoma and have very little access to theaters, you saw everything on cable. So I saw it on a constant loop on HBO or Showtime or whatever it was playing on. And I only saw the theatrical version until the DVD release. And then you saw it, and I was like, wait,
where's the voice?
Where's the voice? So anyway, it doesn't bump me. I appreciate both versions very equally, but I think there's value in this one. So, but I come from it just as a super, super fan and not being able to understand it when I saw it, but love it for whatever reason. You're like, why am I 13 and I love this film?
Yeah.
I didn't understand any of it. And as I've gotten older, it just gets better and better because you understand more about it. So that's where I come from with seeing it and loving it. And of course, I went and saw it with Tim on the re-release.
On the big screen.
We don't want to brag, but we saw it at Warner Brothers with just an amazing picture, amazing sound. Saw a Q&A after with the filmmakers, and Nice.
And the restoration team.
The restoration team that did the DVD releases. Nice. So
wonderful.
I think I saw the 92 director's cut on big screen. I honestly don't remember. I really, really don't. But I got to say, when DVD started coming out, one of the first ones I got was Blade Runner. It was like, I got to get Blade Runner.
It was one of the first ones out, correct, as far as DVD production?
I think it was pretty early.
It's either the first or one of the very first. It might have been the first batch released on DVD. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that was a good call. So, okay, so...
And actually, just last night, my wife, I face-painted her white and put the raccoon black eyes on her and had her jump around the living room.
You had your wife act like Pris?
Yeah, it was way cool, man. Oh, the pleasure leisure model or whatever that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's Blade Runner interactive version.
I think that's for the R-rated version of Film Rock or something.
Speaking of which, I just recently discovered I have a lack of empathy. Should I be worried?
We will be applying the Voight-Kampff test on you later on. So anyway, quick instructions is that we have paused the film right after the Warner Brothers logo has faded to black. So get to that point, pause it, and then we will proceed. And when we're ready to go, which is going to be just a few moments, I will say 3, 2, 1, play. You will hit play at the same time that we do, and we will all be together on this.
Right. So if you haven't done that yet, which we just told you about, always hit pause on this podcast until you set up.
Or revamping. Yep. Just for a tiny little. Okay, fine. You've vamped enough. All right. So on that note, 3, 2, 1, play.
Ooh, look at that pretty tree.
I always love the music to this. This is like Star Wars, where you hear the 20th Century Fox logo.
You always associate it with that.
Because you've got this cue, and then you have the next music cue coming up.
Being the explanation I told you when we saw this, when we were kids, we would always start a movie on Showtime or HBO, and we would not know the title, and we would try to guess what it was before the actual movie started. So we then stop and go, okay, what's your guess? What's it going to be?
Just off of the production company
and
music.
And this one is like totally.
That's very funny.
Like, oh, Blade Runner,
and
get out of here.
Boom.
Yeah. As soon as that would happen, you'd be like, Blade Runner. So.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, Vangelis does a great job. Harrison Ford.
Should we just allow Tim to speak about Vangelis for a second?
Oh, yeah. Why not?
We got introduction to Vangelis.
Tim?
Actually, Serge will be more of an expert on the score to Blade Runner than myself. But thank you, Curtis. I appreciate it. Speaking of which, did you, Serge, mention to me it's Vangelis?
I'd read it somewhere, but you corrected me. I don't know. We'll just say Vangelis because that's what
I personally have always
life.
Heard Vangelis. That's
well, actually, let's talk about Vangelis briefly. He did win the Academy Award the previous year, 1981, for Chariots of Fire. And so when it came time to Blade
Never
Runner,
it.
It's like... and you're why are you here? Okay. Joanna Cassidy. Very nice.
So when it came time for Blade Runner for Vangelis?
They picked him and he did the music and it was very cool.
Was it something that Ridley had wanted to work with him for years and years?
No, I think it was a matter of they were looking around and they, you know, I think it was just a matter of he'd won the Academy Award and it was the type of music that he wanted to possibly use. And
you know what's so nice is that it's great. I mean, it's like unbelievably different than Chariots of Fire and it sets
the mood, the tone where
so darn well.
Before
I mean,
we even see anything, we know where we are.
Well, when I thinking it through, I think it's very interesting that it's a synth score, synthetic.
And this is for 1982.
Oh, right. Oh, very nice.
And if you put it to Blade Runner, it's not an organic, acoustic, symphonic. It's synthetic.
But it makes perfect
score.
Sense.
Now, it marries to the film beautifully.
Should someone read this?
I got to tell you. Okay, here's the crawl that explains what's going on.
So now, early in the 21st century, right?
Well, you don't have to read those. It's okay, really. We are early in the 21st century now. I want my replicant. I want my own replicant. I saw this and I'm like, really? Do we really have to have something explaining what's going on? But it's like, okay, I'll just go with it. It's cool.
Yeah, sci-fi seems to help with like the whole Star Wars crawl and thing. It's like you got to catch up really fast.
Right. And exactly. I mean, this basically lays out everything, all the little details you need to know, so it fills it in. Yeah.
And you got to love that too. It's not called execution.
Now, that's the one little nice piece to that.
It's called retirement.
And personally, for me, they could have shown anything, an old tennis shoe in the corner, and it doesn't matter because this next shot is the money, baby.
Yeah. Exactly.
This shot coming up.
Also, wait, why November? 2019.
Was it like Thanksgiving?
I don't know. Maybe
it's right before Christmas.
This shot right here.
Wow.
What a wonderful way to set the film.
Yeah.
See, and here's the crazy thing with me that makes me more appreciative as I get older, and you see these shots, the way they were done, no CGI, none of that stuff back in those days. All of these are...
It's all miniatures.
All miniatures. What do they call that when they have the when we went and saw this, they explained how they got the fire inside of there. And these are all placed behind the miniatures and everything to be able to get the fire up there perfectly. It's unbelievable. And it holds up sometimes better than a lot of CG shots.
Just what I'm seeing is a lot of optical effects. I'm seeing an optical overlay of the fire over the cityscape. That's the way I read it.
Look at that.
Now, I want to point something out here that... We've been brought in with the music, and now we've been brought in with the visual and how incredibly different this is. Now, I want you to remember this because this gets called back basically in a way at the very end of the film because we've been brought into this world. This is incredible. It's not like, oh, it's a normal world. This is a truly incredible world that we're looking at. Very dark, of course, very smoky.
It's really interesting how they go inside and outside, too, for the go back and forth.
Well, for mood, you have the particles in the air. You had the mist in the miniature photography for the city. Now you have this fog inside this room and just resonance, and you can taste that air. You can feel that air. It's just wonderful atmosphere.
Right. This guy's name is Morgan Paul, I believe. In the when they did the casting, he read the part of Deckard.
Yeah.
Oh, he did. And now he's the guy that gets offed. What's interesting, when he's talking to Leon, look at his eye, because they also do the whole red thing in his eye, which makes me think maybe all Blade Runners are actually replicants.
Do you want to give that theory out on the microphone?
Yes, my theory is that all Blade Runners are replicants.
And I will basically say I...
You concur?
I don't concur at all. I think it's all about the dehumanization of humans and how replicants are maybe more human than humans.
Ooh, very interesting point.
That's what appealed to me the most about this film. That's what got me was that the replicants wanted to be human, couldn't be, and the humans were dehumanized. And that's the whole thing with Deckard. That's why in the later versions about Deckard's a replicant. It doesn't have to be.
Well, I think we can talk. But I mean, right. Obviously, Leon demonstrates a ton of emotions here. I mean, he gets rattled about this tortoise.
I tell you, whenever I see this film, I sit there and look at it, and I look at everything through, like, the choices the directors make in where they frame everything, and you just don't see this type of framing in films as much anymore. Everything's so quick. Everything's so fast. Everything's so jilted, and you get lost in the story because you can't really settle on the emotion that's going on.
Right.
And... I don't know.
Except for Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious.
Of course. We just talked about it. But I love Breon James, by the way.
Yeah.
I love him. And I believe he's dead now. This actor right here, Breon James.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
he's
Leon.
Absolutely unbelievable. And he's one of these character actors that was a great character actor.
You recognize him every time you see him.
Well, he was in everything, but he also would play Russians. He would play Germans. By the way, have fantastic accents. Yeah. As well, and he's just a character. I don't even want to diminish it. He was a character actor that most people wouldn't know as far as their names go.
Yeah. But by sight, you definitely say, I know that guy.
And he was in every cheeseball movie all the way to the grade A movie. Yeah. So
he was in the Fifth Element.
Yes, you're right.
Now, this is great. I like how he's leaned forward, and it's like, that's because I got a gun on you.
Yeah. I also love the Terrell Corp on the back of the chairs.
Yeah.
What everyone has it here, the stamp on them.
Yeah.
Bam.
And the gun just shot him right through a wall.
Yeah, I don't think. Oh, another great shot. Look at the Pan Am. Yeah. This is, of course, an iconic shot of L.A. All of it. And it's so reminiscent, of course, intentionally of Metropolis.
That rain, all that atmosphere. Again, the air has something in it. It's not just CGI where it's so pure and clean. You've got particles in there. It's great. It resonates.
It is one of those things, and I believe it does way more than any CG shot. As great as some CG shots are, it's still to have that physical.
Why don't we have light stick umbrellas yet?
I know. I like it's a nice future-looking style, you, but you're thinking practicality. Yeah,
I got mine yesterday.
Do you think? I bet you they could might actually sell. You could have a Blade Red umbrella.
And it's interesting. I hear that Ridley Scott had the idea of meshing L.A. with Hong Kong and that kind of style, and have the neon everywhere. And
right,
apparently they did not have 16:9 TVs. At this date.
funny. They kind of skipped that. They kind of decided to go back and go back to analog.
No. Well,
here you go.
Oh, here's the voiceover.
This would be new to me. I have never heard the voiceover.
Here's why I like it. Because that is film noir. And this is being film noir, and that's why I appreciate it, and that's why it never bumped me, I don't think.
It never bothered me either. It was it's definitely calling back to
Raymond Chandler and all
noir
that.
It was like a little bit of a resurgence of it. I mean, you have Body Heat also, I think the year before that year.
No, you're right. But you're right. I mean, when I recently watched the final cut, it's obviously not there, and actually it's not really needed. But I like your comment about the film noir.
And it does fit as far as the style for film noir, but wasn't it also the studio's decision thinking that the audience wouldn't be able to follow?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Well, was the release of them originally?
Well, I mean, no, there was a whole thing where basically it was not the studio. It was essentially Bud Yorkin. It was Tandem. And they went back several times. They're like, no, it needs it. Well, because what happened is there were two previews in Dallas and Denver, and people just didn't get it, so they pulled it in the shop and they did the voiceovers. In earlier scripts there had been voiceovers throughout it, which they had just slowly cut out, so they came back to it. I mean, I think it's perfectly fine. It makes things clear, lets us know where we are.
And it is definitely an homage to film noir.
It doesn't take any, I mean, already you've got so much to look at, it doesn't the purity, it just, everything is just...
I love that helmet, huh?
Oh, here, Admiral Adama.
I actually wear that helmet when I drive around in my car in L.A.
That's Adama, you know that? That's Edward James Olmos.
Really?
As playing Gaff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I just want to say, when Harrison Ford delivered the line, Brian A., that's actually the exact same way he delivers Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah. Now, this is another one of those great shots, a series of great shots that basically take you through L.A. of the future.
And kudos to Doug Trumbull with the effects there.
Yeah.
Here's the voiceover again.
And it's fine. It works well.
See, I think that explains a lot. That city speak, gutter talk, that it's a mishmash of languages. Whereas before, if you're watching, you're kind of like, what the hell are they?
Yeah. Exactly. I thought he was talking. Well, yeah, and also shows that Harrison Ford understands that, but wasn't making it
easier
for him.
But as a screenwriter, everybody always is like, well, you shouldn't have to talk. Narration is cheating. But, and it's like,
But in the same respect, I think it complements. But once again, we've got this onslaught of just things you've never seen before.
Yeah, which
these
is nice.
Visuals,
it's beautiful.
Incredible. And of course, now we go to Union Station.
And look at the quality of the air. Again, missed it, baby.
It's a lot of smog.
You gotta love the whole roof all messed up. That's fine.
This office right here, they built in Union Station for this scene.
Oh, nice!
And I shot a film there. Mm-hmm. 12 years ago, and that office was still there. They left it there, and it was empty. And I'm like, I'm walking around like, hey, Blade Runner. But it was still there for the longest time, and now they've taken it down.
Well, they had to have built it without one of the walls.
Well, they had no ceiling on it.
But it was still put there. It together to let it stand for when you showed it, saw it. That's great.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I didn't know that was in the voiceover.
Wow. Holy crap.
But in a lot of ways, it explains how derogatory he is right now, talking about skin jobs.
Exactly. Nobody knew it was that derogatory of a term.
True.
Right.
But now we know that it is very derogatory.
I'll try not to defend every narration, but it's one of those things where I find it valuable.
Well, I'm glad we're doing this because...
You know, I think it's interesting. I've always wondered is if he's being brought in, when did he do this? I always thought it's like, and how many other skin jobs did he have to kill? How many times did this happen?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know where I've heard this now, but from whatever reason, my memory it's I've heard the theory that Emmett Walsh's character brought him in to kind of smoke him out as a replicant also, is what I've heard. And it's like, well, you're getting a little bit too. But that's sci-fi.
But that goes back to the whole thing that Ridley Scott has suggested. Well, that actually his intention was that Deckard was a replicant. I think it takes away from the original experience I had, which was that he's a human. Yes.
Yeah. Let me jump in real quick. That last scene with the whole you're either cop or little people and you have no choice. That's the hypothesis statement for the hero for the movie, mm-hmm. which says this is the way you have to live your life. And then the whole rest of the movie is that true or not? Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the end, he chooses that it's not. He doesn't have to play that way. But for the whole 90% of the movie, he does play it that way. Mm-hmm. He does have to do that. But that's, there you go. And then, of course, then we go right into the next scene, this big structure scene, is what's this movie about? And that usually happens around 15 minutes, and we're right at 14 minutes. So basically, people can watch any movie and hang in there for 15 minutes, and then it's like, okay, what are we doing here? What's going on? What's the mission? What's the goal? What's this about?
So you're saying there's usually a 15-minute window tolerance on an audience's just natural clock watching a film?
I think that goes with conversations, too. If you're talking to a friend, they just start talking, you can hang with them for a while, and then you're finally like, what are you talking about? What's the point of this? Mm-hmm. And then when they tell you the point, then you're like, okay, you're talking about how evil your grandmother is or whatever.
Yeah.
And if your 15 minutes are up, if your 15 minutes are up, then on to something else.
Yeah, right. You're like,
you've explained every conversation I've ever had with my in-laws. What is going on there? Well, I mean, to me, I mean, you look at this scene, and I guess it's a good time to bring up Jordan Cronenwith, the DP, mm-hmm. director of photography. For those
that's
that
right.
Absolutely unbelievable lighting throughout this whole movie, and it's been mimicked in so many other movies. And I think it's partly because of the eye that Ridley Scott has. And you look at some of the stuff that he did earlier in his career; people mimicked it, whether it be Alien, whether it be this film. People always mimic these things, and whether it be maybe Ridley Scott's eye or Cronenwith's, I love it. It's absolutely, but sometimes it makes no sense why that would be there, you know. Mm. And then,
as the logic of lighting,
the logic of lighting, and Tim, you were saying that they used to have arguments about it, Jordan Cronenwith and Ridley Scott, about why would that be there, and Ridley Scott was like, I don't care.
Style versus logic.
Yeah, uh-huh. We don't
aesthetic,
care.
Something that looks cool, eye candy versus the logic.
Yeah, like where is the light coming in on his back head on this scene, and then also on Deckard's head? Yeah. Okay, well, how does that logically fit in? Does it matter? It looks cool.
Right.
Let's put it in there, you know? But it looks unbelievable. And, of course, the adding of the smoke.
Yeah.
And there comes a point for me.
And no one's smoking. I mean, or at least they're all in the ashtray. We don't actually see someone smoking.
But as far as style, there comes a point with me if the style is something like this. I don't need logic whatsoever. I just love looking at all the pretty stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do the visual effects hold up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I like that we both used absolutely. It's
jinx.
Easy.
I think a lot of people have complained before the final restoration of wires and some practical errors happening when they shot, I guess, cars lifting off and things like this and wire removal. But as far as the opticals and the miniatures and the cityscapes, and also I love that the camera's moving on all these cityscape shots you've seen.
It is nice.
Since the beginning of the movie, they aren't static. Also, they had articulation. They had like radar setups on top of buildings rotating. Everything's has its fluidity to it, and this rhythm and this movement, which is just beautiful.
Right. I like also in the the cars. I don't know what they're called again. But the active lighting, which actually, interestingly enough, if you go back to like Star Wars, when they were in the cockpits for the first two Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, is all static lighting. And then in Jedi, they used active lighting, moving the lights around to give you a feel for where you were going. And
you're telling me it took Lucas two films to get that? Oh, I'm sorry.
And what's
look
nice,
at that shot. Don't get me started.
Yeah. Well, it's what's nice about the whole flying around too is it, you know, really highlights the
Sean
little people
Young.
Versus the cop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this is weird. This is
amazing shots.
Yeah, one great shot coming up. There it is. Look at that.
And then when she walks into frame, watch this. This is what the amazing DP work is. Watch this.
Look at this.
Yep, she walked right through a shadow, right into it.
Mm-hmm. I think she hit her mark.
Yeah.
Also, the depth of field, everything out of focus in the back.
Sure.
But as far as film noir, noir, black film noir filled with shadows. And I love this because it's not a high key, none of this high key lighting. You see the entire set. You have these shafts and shafts of shadow and darkness, which is just, to me, the noir feel.
Yeah, I mean, and it just, you can definitely tell that deep in Scott's mind was of blending the noir aesthetic and also the detective story, essentially. You know, and he's essentially got to find non-humans and discern that.
And where is this water effect from the lighting coming
from? The reflection.
That's the thing.
All this reflection.
Yeah, and it's like, it makes no sense when you look at the actual lighting, but then you're like, all right, I can dig it.
Looks pretty. I like it.
There is a famous story with this scene right here. When they were about to start shooting this scene, they had set up the set and everything. And, you know, of course, by this time, Ridley Scott had not made friends on the film with the American crew. It was the first American crew he worked with, we were talking about earlier. And he goes on and he looks at the set, and he had okayed the set already. And then he goes in and they're about to start filming. And then he looks at the pillars and he said, you know what? I don't like them. And he asked them to turn them upside down and flip them. And so he had to flip all these pillars. The tops were at the bottom and the bottoms were at the top from what we see right now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he started his career out as an art, well, part of his career was doing art direction.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what he did. I mean, that was part of what he knew. So, and I love this effect, how what they do is they bring essentially the screen down, but only almost all the way. And then you have this horizontal shaft of light that just gives, I mean, not only is it beautiful, it's so just effective mood wise and it cuts right across his face.
Which is interesting.
Because
an actor's face is mostly in shadow, which is interesting. Most people would light it so we see all his face.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's just visually so different than most anything you'd see.
Highly stylized.
I also like the bonsai trees, which sort of means that they're like peaceful and yet, you know, centered and all that good stuff, and yet they're making and killing people.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
There's some incongruity there.
Yes.
I would like to put in that this is a good point of good writing, good directing will always overcome bad acting. Have you seen Sean Young in a better role since this?
Well, I think with Sean Young, she was cast well. That's the whole thing. She was cast.
Look at those eyes.
She could do well. That's lighting also. She could do what she did.
But I mean, that's the thing is like so much of that is overlooked, and you're like, wow. I mean, we're just going to put actor A in the part. Well, because they sell tickets, and that makes very logical sense in today's modern marketing tools and everything else. But at the same time, it's like, look at her. She's perfect in the part. She's unbelievable.
See that line.
I just like the fact that she said lesbian.
Well, exactly. That got a laugh in the theater. That's the thing.
Oh, did it?
Oh, totally got a laugh in the theater.
Well, back then that was pretty. People didn't really say that out loud back.
I think you still get a laugh in the theater.
The vibe I'm seeing on an acting level, what to me would be a director's intention: less is more. Mm-hmm. Everything is just dialed down.
Yeah.
I don't see a lot of facial tics. I don't see a lot of reaction in the faces through this film. Just dial it down. Less is more.
But I think that goes to the whole, you know, humans are dehumanized and the non-humans, the replicants, are trying to be human. So there's a flattening of everything. There's a flattening of humanity, really. I mean, this is all about how humanity is essentially being crushed. I mean, if you look at the environment outside, I mean, how do you live in that without having your humanity crushed? It's raining all the time. It's dark. It's polluted. Mm-hmm. Most people are going off world. It's like, why are you staying on world type of thing? Actually, to that end, briefly mention, most people know this, that this is based on a book called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. And one of the things that was taken out from the book is the whole thing of Deckard wanting to get an electric sheep, essentially, an android sheep.
For his wife, correct? If I remember right?
I don't remember. It's been a little while. But
was he married?
I believe he was married.
Okay.
Actually, I think there's a comic adaptation that's been done recently of the book. So, yeah, but basically the idea...
Because the wife just wanted a pet sheep?
Because all the animals apparently died from a kind of... No, from a virus. No, that's the whole thing.
And they reference it later when you see her with the snake. And he's like, is that real? Come on. Are you kidding me? Right, it's not real. Who can afford a real snake?
Right. I mean, there are none. So this world has really poisoned itself. And now what they're doing is, I mean, this is, you know, Mr. Terrell, and he's making more than humans. I don't know what you call it, replicants, essentially.
And like the owl that flew across.
Now, here structurally, John, does this hit any points?
No. Well, I mean, this is just developing characters between what's this movie about, and then they haven't entered the second act yet.
Because we've just we've gotten the key point of information is that Rachel's a replicant.
Yes,
going to shape the whole.
It does.
Thrust of the film.
But where Decker goes into the second act with his new world is Rachel shows up at his place. Now it's because he's dealt with replicants before.
Right.
But now he's really getting in on a personal relationship with her.
Right. The Yuka.
And he chooses it. Because here, right there, he learns it. Now he's got a choice. Does he associate with her or does he not?
Right.
Or does he just end up killing her? And of course,
right.
Pretty soon he ends up with building a relationship or starting a relationship.
I love that guy outside. The janitor. Yeah. The landlord. Oh, here's a door. But even look outside, the blue, I guess, neon or lights. Everything is definitely reminiscent of 30s, 40s architecture. Mm-hmm. It's all so retro. I mean, this is like film noir
brought
in the
future. Into science fiction.
Well, I read an interview with Ridley Scott, and he said he was actually more interested in designing a bathroom and a kitchen than necessarily outside city, because he was like, well, what would a bathroom kitchen really look like in all reality in the future rather than some Jetson type thing, you know?
Well, he's also going to the downtown area, which is full of, you know, great old architecture and drawn from that.
Well, but a lot of their sets were built. They meshed so well, and the angles of all the architecture that they used and the differences like that. But what I like about all the interiors, and speaking of film noir and bringing it back home, is everything is... Actually, if you think about it in space age ways, you know, this is at that time, if we're jumping ahead into the future where we have flying cars, everything is very, very unpractical. You have old TVs, you have old lights. They had an antenna on the TV back there in that last scene. Yeah. You're like, that wouldn't be there, but it's so awesome looking.
Yeah.
It just looks great.
I just love how lived in and worn everything is. Right. I'll never forget when I first saw Alien, Ridley Scott, the ships. They were the most dirty, disgusting than the Nostromo. Yeah.
But they'd fly through space, wouldn't they? I mean,
it's not clean. It's not the 1960s sci-fi, the 50s.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Ridley Scott, everything is lived in. It has history. It has...
This, even the street.
Well, I mean, look at this. But I have to say, you got to credit Lucas with that.
You'll see that later in the
Lucas,
film, by the way.
Yeah, it shows up at the end of the film. Well, there's a reason for that. But Lucas with Star Wars, that was the charm of Star Wars. Star Wars was a lived-in universe.
We're talking the original Star Wars, yes.
Star Wars, this is, A New Hope.
Exactly.
1977.
2 years before
but
Alien.
Exactly, and that was the whole charm of it.
That's a great line. Did you get your precious photos? He's totally mocking him for holding on to memories that he knows that is fake.
I have a question about the name of the actor. Is it pronounced Rutger or Rutger?
Howard. I thought it was Rutger Hauer.
Okay.
Rutger. I mean,
he's awesome.
One of the best, I won't even call him a bad guy, one of the best anti-heroes in a film, in my view. Yeah. I totally, totally understand his character much more
of my
age right now than I did then.
But look at this, how he goes from there and he dollies across and has everyone.
That's
all on
set in Warner Brothers, by the way, too.
Was it?
Yeah, that's on a stage. That's not even on the exteriors, I believe.
You're right. I mean, an important thing to notice as we're talking about art design, I mean, just the complete saturation with what I'll call Asian, since I don't know exactly if it's Chinese or Japanese. Iconography. It's like Asia has come to L.A., which I think back, you know.
I think that was forward-thinking.
It was forward-thinking back then, how much it would be here. I mean, obviously, this is not what it's going to be like in 2019. That we should come back in 2019 and find, well,
we have
got a lot of building to do.
We have the Asian advertising going on the side of buildings on those cityscape shots. We have the women in the kimonos, and we had the bonsai trees, John, that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And now we have just what Sarah spoke about. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is a.
We don't have the flying cars.
No. What I'm saying, as far as what we're looking at in the film so far, these statements that have been made along the Asian influence.
Right.
I'm not saying what we have presently today.
But I want a flying car. It's a great quote.
And it's great because, you know, he's talking to his assistant, and now we know that his assistant is dead without even seeing it.
Yeah.
We know that these guys
I've seen that guy in tons of stuff.
Yeah, because the guy understands
it's he's James Hong.
He's a replicant.
Great actor. Well, actually, no, he doesn't know. He's going to find out now.
And that's actually the stuff they now use at raves. I'm serious, to make their bodies glow and stuff.
Sure. No, I think that's supposed to be, they're suggesting that's liquid nitrogen.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they use, yeah, I hear you.
On set, it was.
No. I don't think they use liquid nitrogen. Raves.
So that's James Hong. Okay.
Yeah. He's been in lots of stuff. He was in, I think Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. The only problem with this whole scene. Yes. Oh, wait, never mind. You did see his breath. My bad.
Yeah.
Totally.
Well, they dropped down the temperature for
and
this.
And it's not digitally added.
No James Cameron Titanic post work on this.
Yeah.
Or, what is it? Not Conan the Destroyer. Oh, it was bad.
As an actor, it must be so much easier to work in that atmosphere, too, because you must love the fact that this guy's going to put it down to 0 degrees and you have to wear coats and you're going to be shivering.
Yeah.
I would think it would help.
For motivation, but when you go into past golden time, when someone's very demanding, I don't know how pleasing that may be.
Yeah, it's like, dude, I've been cold for 12 hours. It sucks.
And all that investment is on the screen for all of us to enjoy from here on out.
Questions. A little pop culture trivia. Whenever Anne Rice wrote Interview with the Vampire, she envisioned Rutger Hauer as Lestat.
Nice.
That's where she derived this from, was from Blade Runner, seeing him in Blade Runner, and that's where she got the idea for Lestat.
Oh, I could see that. He'd be an awesome vampire.
Now, this is the first. Well, this is his first scene. We were introduced basically to the replicants by Leon, and now we see as basically Roy's making his way, through whatever it's going to take to get to Terrell.
Right, and when he gets Sebastian's name, that's actually the turning point from the first act to the second act.
I was going to mention about the eye there.
Yeah.
There's a thing with the eyes because he's playing with the eye. I mean, first of all, it's I don't want to say fetishism, but it's basically it's playing. I mean, he's taking actual body parts and essentially, if you want, assaulting him with their disembodiment.
Mm-hmm.
But this comes back later. He actually, remember when he does to Terrell, he takes his eyes out. So there's a lot of eye symbolism. Tunnels in downtown LA.
Wear it.
Yes.
Made famous in Terminator.
Okay, yes. Right. I know.
A great tunnel to shoot in.
Yeah. It's great lighting.
That seems a little THX 1138 to me.
It does, which was shot in the BART before they put the subways in.
You know, as far as all the eye candy and stylization in this film, to me, it's just such a great science fiction film because of ideas. To me, science fiction is such a wonderful way to present ideas. And the idea that I came away with from this film to statements of humanity and everything, I just think are just awesome. It's not just all about gadgets, eye candy, and stimulus. It has a wonderful idea in it.
And here we go.
And I know, I think it's great that she was in the elevator already.
I like the elevator. The elevator's a great design. And it's, of course, all based on Frank Lloyd Wright.
What a great movie.
Frank Lloyd Wright's designs.
Throwing that camera in there, or that gun into camera.
Yeah.
I like how we hear the wind.
Do you see now that he's like totally distraught because he knows that she's a replicant and
he's definitely torn.
Well, she just scared the crap out of him.
Yeah, that too. Yeah.
She was there in the elevator.
See, now watching this after me now as a grown up watching this, I think he is a replicant, and part of that thing in the elevator is him deteriorating, like they say they do. They have a lifespan,
and so I now
look at that and I'm like, he's kind of aging and he's on his last leg, kind of a situation.
It's the demand need or what some people talk about of his job is kill replicants.
Sure.
His heart is I love her. And so now we got a huge conflict going on.
That's the whole thing. I agree with you. He is attracted to her, but now he knows she's a replicant. It's like, well, I can't I can't do it with a skin job. There's just no way.
He doesn't know what to do. And
there's
he also,
no way I can do it with a skin job. I'm human. No way. Not going to happen.
I can agree but with everything her. You said, but that's what makes this film so good is you can have these arguments in your
on
head.
On both sides.
And you can hear both sides, and they're like, oh, well, that
and
it's 2000, makes sense.
It's 2007, and we're debating what they've been debating since 1982. You know?
That's right.
That's like, wonderful.
It's awesome. So, well, who's right? Who's wrong?
Well, I want to know. Well, where's that unicorn that we see later on?
We don't see it in this.
We don't see it in this version.
It's not in this version.
They took my unicorn?
It's not your unicorn. It was never there.
Unicorn from Legends. Legend.
Right, but when we see it, is it going on inside his mind?
Yeah.
Okay.
Theoretically, he's dreaming of the unicorn.
That's what I was thinking.
But here, it's not there. And see, There's actually an interesting story about this, actually. Hampton Fancher got that story about the baby spiders from Barbara Hershey. Mm-hmm. So that's something that happened to her as a child.
Right. Yeah. Barbara Hershey.
But see, the very fact that he knows about her memories that make her life real, part of what makes Harrison Ford's life, or whatever his name is in this thing.
Oh, don't say that.
Rick Deckard.
He will always be Han Solo to me.
Okay.
So he's like, he's got the memory of a unicorn, and what's the last paper image that Gaff leaves outside the door?
Sure.
You know. So he's saying, I know.
Beautifully lit shot here with Sean Young.
And he's like, I know you're a replicant.
And now he feels shit. She's telling her.
Sean Young might not be a great actress, but probably Ridley Scott was off camera yelling at her before they started filming.
I will take you to task for that. I think you can hear whatever stories you hear about Sean Young.
Mm-hmm. I think she's
actually a really good actress. And I worked on a film with her. Trust me, she's a really good actress.
Glad to hear
all right.
That. I only go and off the Ace Ventura, I guess. I'm just kidding.
Well,
being a smart ass. I 100% understand exactly what you're saying.
I just like her
big hood there.
And here, her performance is great.
Like the vibe and the music there.
Oh, the music is just perfect.
Again, look at all that shadow. Look at all that darkness.
And he walks out of the kitchen, and you know it dims itself.
We have to have the line coming through the shutters.
What's great, too, is the arc of their relationship is he doesn't run after her right here. Mm-hmm. That would have been way too soon. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Now, this was an interesting shot here. I always wondered about this. This was coming up. Hang on. Right. I think it's coming up right here.
Yeah.
Right here, where the picture actually moves.
The shadows.
I'm like,
along the picture.
It's kind of cool.
Well, that was interesting. Wonderful. It just went to video, you know, actual.
Well, it was very
that's
Harry
a wonderful
Potter.
Choice. I love
very
that choice.
Harry Potter.
It was so different.
Brought it to life.
Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter pictures move.
Oh, jeez. Okay. All right.
There's the mirror that's going to be called back here in a little bit.
Right.
I personally love shots where you get to see the ceilings in rooms. Mm-hmm. I do. You don't have to do that. It's a lot more work to put in ceilings. Mm-hmm. And it looks beautiful.
It's harder to light.
It's a lot more work, absolutely. Nice little match shot going on there, huh?
Several.
We have some opticals back
look
there.
Look how you can see the tint of something burning off those lights right there.
And now we're going to the replicant's storyline.
And real quick, the reason why that was the start of Act Two with Deckard and Rachel was because that's the first time he's had, or at least my understanding of the character, such a connection and actually feeling bad for a replicant. And so now he's entering a whole new world. Even though through the voiceover and everything else, we know he doesn't want to be a killer anymore, but this just, you know, takes it to a whole new level.
Right. Even though we have not seen him kill a replicant yet.
Right. Which is interesting.
I have seen that miniature right there in that shot that we just had the flying vehicle.
Right.
And it's not very big whatsoever. I'd say it's about 2.5 feet long. Mm-hmm. That's it. It's just so detailed, and they shot it so beautifully.
You've actually seen the actual
physical. Yes, it's at Warner Brothers. It was at the museum at Warner Brothers.
Nice.
I was surprised at how small it is. It looks so
huge. Daryl Hannah, was this pre or post Splash?
This is pre.
What?
She was like,
that's
well, we're just recognizing on the back lot of Warner's where this scene shot.
Right.
Actually, Curtis, you pointed this area out to me after we saw the screening in 2007. Mm-hmm. We left the S.J. Ross Theater, or was shown, and it's just right across the street from the main theater at the studio.
Yeah. I think also, though, I think I might be wrong on this. I don't think that's Stephen J. Ross. I think this is an actual practical set in downtown L.A.
You know what? I think this might
be
downtown.
And then they brought the pillars to that location, and that's an actual theater in L.A.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
This isn't like along New York Street or something.
No, I mean
Warner Brothers.
But I think I only know that from watching the commentaries on some of the DVDs and such.
No, but now that you mentioned it, because I was looking at some of the storefronts, I'm like, it's not all. Because backlot streets look, I hate to say it, look like backlot streets.
But they did a fantastic job in this one of making them look very, very real.
Right. Mm.
See, I like, even look at these pillars right here. Look how worn and torn and broken up they are. I mean, like Tim said,
weathered.
In today's modern, like take iRobot, another Philip K. Dick book, and everything is clean and
No. iRobot was based theoretically on Isaac Asimov's book, and it had nothing to do with the story.
I apologize. That's okay. But as far as sci-fi goes, that's what bugs me about a lot of the sci-fi stuff now. It's like, okay, it's all perfect and pristine. And
well, let's get back to this whole idea is that this presented such an oppressive, essentially a dystopic view of the future, which Star Wars had hinted at, but Star Wars is still lived in. But this was definitely a dystopia here.
Sure.
And this definitely, I mean, we know, Aaron, anyone who's listening to this, I'm sure knows, is that this inspired many, many films, books, and everything. Definitely inspired cyberpunk, was the inspiration for Neuromancer, which is considered the, I guess, the first cyberpunk novel.
Mm-hmm.
Inspired movies like Akira. Mm-hmm. I mean, that whole dystopic future, all that can be traced back to here.
Yeah, I always like those little shots with Daryl Hanlon just did with, when you see
shot.
An actor acting something else, and then the other person turns their head, and then you see their true face come on.
Sure.
I dig those, you know, because it really...
going from a story point of view right here, I mean, if you noticed right there, Daryl Hannah's character seems like she's acting. Well, she is, because she's pulling him in to baiting him in, and they're working in tandem with each other, her and Batty, to get in and...
Right. Get inside to Terrell, which is great.
Exactly. So it's Bradbury Building.
So,
they made it look fantastic.
An interesting thing about this set right here,
look at all
that
water.
They had to clean this up every single day. They shot overnight, and these offices were still working as they were shooting the movie. And every single day would come back and clean. Look at all the water on the floor. And they would clean that up so people could go to work the next day.
Wow.
Insanity.
That is insane.
And if you have fog, you have to have moving lights. It's like a discotheque.
Might as well.
That's just.
But it's motivated. I mean, the idea is it's coming from the blimp.
I know that.
The dirigible.
I know that, but.
The dirigible?
Yeah,
dirigible. Right?
Dirigible?
But dirigible. Now that light is right overhead them and then there, and it's like it seems like it's everywhere you go.
Yeah.
That lighting out there, the shafts of light, is very reminiscent of Harry Dean Stanton in Alien, where he gets it in the shaft with the rain coming down. You have your typical Ridley Scott styles, I think.
And now here you have essentially the replicants, the robots that didn't work.
I won't say that me and my brothers used to march around the house
toys
like little robots, but they won't say
you marched around
the island of misbegotten toys.
Jiggity, jiggity, jiggity. And we would do that stuff. And we were such dorks, but we loved it.
Home again.
We'd call each other out like that. Okay, I'll shut up now.
It's a great wide shot, huh?
Could you guys help me with the name of the actor on the right?
Bob.
This is William Sanderson.
William Sanderson playing J.F. Sebastian.
Yeah, he's
another great character.
He was on the Newhart show for a number of years.
Larry Darrell and Daryl.
Larry.
Yeah, I think he was Larry. And then he was in Deadwood. He had a part in that. I mean, he's on stuff all over the place.
He was the piano player in Lonesome Dove. He was a guy.
Amazing actor. Oh, now we're back to Deckard. And now he's, you know.
Right, and if you're watching the final cut, this is where you get the unicorn scene. That's inside his
I
head.
See now. Thank you.
But I don't think you need it.
Well, I like it from the fact that it ties in at the end that Gaff knew that he was a replicant, and also he's saying, I was here and I'm letting you go rather than you're beating me. And that's actually the final conflict at the end, is it that the twist is that there is no final battle. And because, well, for me, if you're willing, the heart wins out.
Well, but for me,
that's what the whole movie's about.
Yeah, but for me, this scene here, mm-hmm. where he's at the piano and he's looking at all his pictures, all the old pictures, yeah. his memories, what it is to be yeah. human, his music. Obviously, he plays the piano, mm-hmm. and reflecting, I mean, just how much of it he even, you know, it even affects his life.
This is where you
as a human here now in 2019 with the rain and the replicants, mm-hmm. and he's killing people and everything's mm-hmm. for crap. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is where you can get into the geek arguments where he was just basically diminishing her whole life by saying, your pictures aren't real. These were all made right. up. These were all fabricated. Right. And then he's staring at pictures.
And now right.
But that's, like, but that's great character development.
Well,
sense
that's
that,
true.
I mean,
but
the
he
sense
could
that he would do that
saying,
to her.
I'm confused myself. Or, why? What is my attachment?
Or it could
but
be
me
saying
as,
to
but
us,
me as a human, I'm confused about my memories because all I have are the photos. What do they really mean?
Well, that's one side. Or the next step is, the writer-director saying, she's set up, she's not real, maybe these her photos aren't real either.
It's not beating you over the head, it's just hinting at the fact.
Yeah.
And then that's also where it comes in, where Philip K. Dick was such a great writer. He's setting that up as just human emotion that well, now you're questioning, and how human is human?
Yeah.
How fake is robot? You know what I mean? Right, I mean, it's like, what is it? Well, they must have emotion, whether it be falsified or not. They have emotion.
Right.
But that was
your
my point.
Your conflict. Yeah, I'm agreeing with you.
And those are the ideas I love out of this film that it brings up.
Yeah.
I think what I took out of it was just humans wasting what we take for granted, our life. What is that? And people who don't get that same shot, how much they're going to want that.
But what I took of it.
The replicants.
What I took out of it also is that, I mean, it's humans. It's basically challenging him as a human to betray his humanity by actually trying to have a relationship with a non-human.
Mm-hmm. Which his humanity?
Well, betraying his humanity because essentially technically speaking, is that bestiality?
No, I think he's more human because the whole point is he's not killing. When you're a machine, you're killing.
No, I'm not talking about killing. I'm talking about him loving Rachel.
That's more human because love is human. I see. A machine cannot love.
Right, but this.
So if he can love, then he's actually being more human.
Well,
Rachel.
You're saying machines can't love, but here the replicants. I mean, you see Roy clearly. He loves Pris.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I'm saying machines. They're not machines. They've changed. They've switched over.
Well, actually, this gets another thing. Yeah. I wrote a paper on this in college.
May I?
It's all coming back. Well, hang on. I want to finish this point. Is that this deals with man as God also. I mean, essentially, Terrell, man is God. We create creatures. Then we have to live. We have to deal with the consequences.
Sure.
That's what the Frankenstein story is. Exactly. And how do I interact with something that is created by me? It is not the same as me. It is not human. So, that's just a tension in there. I just find it very interesting. It is inconclusive. Tim?
Did you have a thought on this scene?
Yeah, the moment's passed.
The moment's passed, but that whole scene we just all spoke over was one of the better scenes in the movie. And what's so weird, or I think kind of cool about it, is it's such technologically, it wouldn't happen, we know today, but it fits the movie in the pacing of the whole scene and the way that they go in real slow and you're able to see him discovering all this stuff, being a detective, figuring it out.
Right.
And the reveal
of it is so heightened because of the lack of technology, that it's such a great scene of him pull back out, pan left, three, doing all that stuff back in, and you know.
Well, it's how do you present the revealing of truth?
Exactly.
And that's just a wonderful dramatic device.
Yeah, the way it was
for us to be hanging by a thread thinking, is that?
But
where are we
today
going?
We would just show it. Okay, we're right there. Okay,
it was a wonderful choice.
Boom, and, you know.
Right.
Good directorial choice.
Well, I mean, Ridley Scott definitely takes his, I mean, once again, it gets back to like the more, let's just say, more elegant, slower rhythms of the earlier days of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. It's like when you read a good book, you know, a good mystery book.
Mm-hmm. I love that there's a serial number right there.
On the inside of that little thing. It's awesome.
Yeah, that is great.
And it's just like casual technology. Oh, I pop it in here. Okay.
And also talk about forward thinking. What this film brings up clone-wise and what has just come into fruition since. Oh, my gosh.
But that's where Philip K. Dick comes in. It's like, this guy wrote these books in the 50s and the 60s, and you're like, wow, this guy is scary.
I think it's unsettling to watch this film now.
This was written in 1968.
It's crazy.
1968.
That's insane. Yeah. So
I just want to know how much does it cost to make a fake ostrich, and is it really cost prohibitive? You know what I'm saying?
Do we really need them?
Can you imagine the wranglers on set that day? We have a pony, we have an ostrich, we have.
I like. See, that's a little police station. There's a guy stationed inside it.
Yeah, and we're like, basically the call for that day on extras was, can you bring your own anacondas and cobras and, right. and ostriches and ponies?
And Harrison Ford separated by glass.
And you know what's really intriguing about Dark. You know about this film, and mm-hmm. I mean we see a lot of it in these particular scenes. Is the and you know actually where's the book? Well, there's a lot of that. Oh, I like the filtering of the voice. Basically, there's a lot of layering of details just in foreground, background, and just all. I mean, look at the windows and everything that's going on, and even going down there. Mm-hmm. There's a book called Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner by Paul M. Salmon, I guess it's pronounced S-A-M-M-O-N. Mm-hmm. And basically, he was a writer for Cine Fantastique, and he started out by writing, just doing, you know, a few articles, and wound up writing a ton of articles and turning everything into a book 10, 15 years later. So it's a great trove of information mm-hmm. if you don't have it. This is the bar where, that's right, she's doing the snake dance.
And right now, L.A., you cannot smoke at bars.
Right.
I like this guy.
And I like how they mix the, you know, just different styles and even reaching back even further than film mm-hmm. noir and the hairstyles.
And he's
creating something new.
He's looking at a Polaroid. Dig that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Polaroids actually are making a little bit of a comeback.
A one-touch. They're not completely gone.
Yeah, that's right.
My favorite's a telephone call.
So, yeah. So here's
coming up.
Right. Well, and that's the 45-minute scene where we know how it's going to end. Where in the midst of all this, he wants to connect up with Rachel. That's the next big step of, oh, I got free drinks. Who can I spend time with? And he calls Rachel. And I think it's great that she says
he's
no, she's not coming down.
He's such a bad man.
I feel like I want to hear the cantina theme from Star Wars in this scene.
I mean, I've always felt that really he treats her so shitty.
You think he treats her shitty? Rachel?
But I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know why I feel that. He's not.
Well, he's inviting her down to a drink.
So I like that. Hang on. Yeah. I love this phone. And I like the graffiti on it.
Yeah.
Now that is
LA. It's a little bell thing. That's why he's being
so
shitty.
Sarcastic.
Yeah. You got the camera below.
Oh, his camera is below?
Yeah.
The one that's shooting him?
Yeah,
I
right
see.
There. It's like an ATM.
Transmitting.
And she's like...
Nip. We have Bell. Oh, Bell telephone. Lower right-hand corner.
Mm. And boom. $1.25. Love it.
That's great.
And you know, the nostalgic... number and the old fonts from the mm-hmm. computers are making a comeback now on modern computers. People are putting
just as
fun. They're putting them, you know, in letters and things. Yeah. Those old Apple computer fonts and stuff like that. They're coming back.
My cell phone. I have a message. It actually shows me an audio cassette image, like you see on an old answering machine, which I thought was pretty funny.
What's really interesting about this is that I know they planned on shooting this whole dance, but this works fantastically this way. All you need is that look.
Yeah.
And boom, you know exactly how it went.
He's not fully comfortable being there either.
Well, and that's the thing actually about this film is that there's a lot of detail and detail in the background, but you don't need to see everything to know everything that's out there. We only see parts of the city. We never see the whole city.
Right.
As my
what is suggested is you take it and run with it.
Right, as my friend Trey calls it, he's footprint in the snow.
Footprint in the snow.
I love the choices that Harrison Ford makes right here to all of a sudden go into this nerdy fake.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that is nice.
Excuse me, ma'am. It's awesome.
That would be Joanna Cassidy, correct?
Oh, my God. I'm sorry for whoever might be listening to this. If I met her today, I still might make a pass at her.
Worked on a film with her a few years ago.
Looks amazing.
Very nice one. Very nice.
You're taking it a whole other angle there, Serge. That's not what I was talking about.
Not,
anyway, I'm sorry.
I was Joanne, being polite. She is actually very nice.
She's
very nice
person. She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Of course, I was always... That's her snake, by the way. That is apparently, that was her snake.
That was in real life. She owned a snake and brought it to the film.
Yes, nice. Sir.
Wow.
Was it a real snake or was it fake?
What's
of course it's real. It's great. It's a replicant.
The whole conversation is fun too because it's she just got off stage doing some lewd thing with the snake, and here he is talking about being lewd behavior.
But again, with the forward thinking, how much time in LA do people spend saying, "Is it real or is it fake?" In today's world, whether it's cosmetic that's enhancement, true. Whether it's this, what you're wearing, what you're looking at, what you're seeing, I think that's very topical.
I actually like the fact that to me he makes a choice as an actor to act like he's uncomfortable.
Oh, right, right.
He's not uncomfortable.
Right.
He could give two shits if she's getting undressed in front of him. He's like, all right. And now look at him. He's back into his, he's back, he's Deckard now.
Yeah, he's trying to find the scale. He wants to figure out if she's
But before, he was like, hey, looking around, not looking her in the eye, paying attention. But on a, to go back, if anybody was watching that, that whole scene before was done with one camera move.
Wow.
Fantastic.
Master shot.
Yeah, just kept going.
I won't comment. I won't comment. I won't comment.
Curtis, was it you that mentioned to me that...
I like those boots.
You had heard Harrison Ford keeps a Rolodex of his reactions throughout a film?
No, that wasn't me, but that's interesting.
Someone had mentioned to me that there was a technique he used where he would categorize his reactions throughout the film so he didn't repeat them.
Oh.
And he kept a Rolodex of the chronology.
That's right.
Interesting.
That's hearsay. I'm not saying that's the case.
Yeah. Harrison, if you listen to this, please.
That's a great hit.
I never understood the reasoning behind having a plastic see-through raincoat as a piece of clothing, but I dig it.
I think she wants to keep herself dry.
In her case. And see, you know, this is a kid watching this. I'm like, wait a minute. How could a woman choke this guy? Well, she's a replicant. She's
very
much more powerful than him.
Right.
And I'm interested to watch this because I've really never seen the original death scene of hers that they reshot.
You saw Final Cut, right?
See, but I've not seen this since they've redone it either. Did they go back and still add her face and put it on top of
Final,
the stuntwoman?
Final Cut, they added her face.
To what?
To when she falls.
Okay.
Because you can kind of tell it's a stunt person, but maybe not really.
Well, it's an amazing stunt. Even when you knew it was a stunt woman, I thought it was awesome.
But in the original, it's fairly evident that it's not her.
Yeah.
In the slow motion shot that would be coming up.
But what's great is the death is so so not glorious. I mean, it's like brutal.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which is fantastic.
Right. And notice how long he makes it. You have to go through Harry Krishna's.
Yeah, I love that.
And
Amish, or I'm sorry, Amish? Jewish.
Yes, Hasidic Jew. Amish.
Well, I grew up with Amish. They look alike a little bit.
I didn't grow up with the Hasids, but still. No, but my point being is that how, look at all the detail and all the obstacles
in his
way to get her. I mean, he could have gone in there, found out, he could have shot her right there.
And the Atari is great.
Which,
of course, is gone now. Well, with the old Atari is.
What I love about this whole chase scene is, unlike today's modern filmmaking, it would seem like everybody would want to show you what's going on around them, but everything is pretty tight shots. You have this lush atmosphere, and actually they built it on set. If you've ever read any of the books or seen the making ofs, it was all there, but yet everything was shot on them instead of focusing, George Lucas, on the atmosphere around them.
Or to show off the set. It's wonderful clutter. To intensify the frustration.
Well, that has to do with the directing.
And the congestion of the city.
It has to do with Ridley Scott saying, this is where I want to focus. You know, I mean, look, that was just a nice push-in. This is where I want to focus, and I want to...
Well, I can't believe he's actually thinking about taking a shot with all these people around him. He must be really good, man.
The people around him aren't batting an eye as he's running around with a gun, which, again, very topical to L.A.
See, but I like the fact that they had that old 50s caddy right there. Yeah. That's awesome. Boom.
And it's nice that he misses the first time.
And then he brings the music in.
There you go.
Boom.
Little squib action there.
This is the shot with the...
Yes. Oh, yeah. You're right. They didn't put her face on this one. That's right.
Right. But this is his first kill in the movie that we see.
Yeah.
You know?
and she keeps on going.
Yeah, that's great.
All right.
Oh,
it's interesting. They flipped. They went to the other side.
Mm-hmm. Point of view
of the line.
That's tough.
I don't think she had the right clothes on for that.
Well, it's really nice that you get to see the, all the blood on the plastic.
Well, that's part of why which is very
nice,
done that way.
Nice choice.
Yeah. I mean, you could say, I don't know, you could take it anyway symbolically. I think it worked great.
And also, is that snow that's in the display?
Yes,
you have the blood against the snow?
It is. Yeah. It's flat. It's fake snow. And there she is. Look how she's dead. She's not. She's all.
She's stiff.
She's already stiff.
She's
like.
She's
she
robot.
Doesn't die like a human.
And also
does.
All the mannequins right behind him, which is nice too.
Yeah. And look at that. She's already all rigor mortis.
See, but if your theory.
What theory?
If your theory is that he's human, well, he just feels bad that he just kind of felt, even though he's killed just a replicant, it still stinks for what the dialogue was he said, which you shoot him in the back. If you believe that he's a replicant, well, he feels bad because, well, he's a replicant. He just doesn't know why he feels bad about killing a replicant.
Well, I like the idea that he's human, and I mean, he didn't want to be a Blade Runner anymore. He didn't want to kill replicants, and he's being forced into doing it again, so he does his job for whatever reasons, but he doesn't want to.
Right.
And he's being forced to.
I'm just saying there's no difference between replicant and human.
Hey,
no difference in no difference in what way?
Well, I mean, if they can have emotion and connection, then there is...
There's only the physical differences, which is replicants can only live for 4 years.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I've heard that, Ridley Scott and Harrison Ford both came from a directing and acting point of view that he was a replicant.
Actually, I know. What I've read is that Harrison Ford came from it that he was human. Ridley Scott said afterwards, he's a replicant.
Well, I think, or at least if he did was a replicant, then he thought he was a replicant that was human.
Now, that's interesting.
Because at the beginning,
he thinks he's a replicant. It's like, am I human? I don't know.
Irregardless, I think it's a wonderful device.
Yeah.
So it can be up for debate.
Here's the midpoint. The bad guy's worse than we thought. Do you hear that? Four more to go. Three. Four. Who's the fourth one?
He is.
No. Rachel.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rachel.
And he called her a skin job.
Yeah.
No, because it's...
Yeah.
Three.
And Rachel. Right. So that's what... Now he's worse than we thought, because now he's saying, you got to kill your would-be good girlfriend now.
And he's also saying, we know about your would-be girlfriend,
too, right.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
There's that. I mean, definitely the sense of paranoia, oppression, and of course she is.
There she is. And now, when he goes after her, he's not going after her to kill her. She actually came down to see him, which is awesome.
He doesn't want to kill her because he would have killed her in the apartment. Right. He would have found some way, but he's already made the decision. It's like, I'm not going to kill her. I can't kill her.
Right. But this is right after the midpoint where the bad guy's worse than we thought. We get the next scene, which is usually, where's this movie going?
And then the bad guy is even worse than you thought.
right. Leon shows up, which is nice.
That's not an answer.
That's great. That's great writing.
I
great
hit
acting.
You, and then I don't know.
Yeah.
Some handheld
camera
work.
A lot of
work.
People don't know that... Breon James is actually a big dude.
I mean,
look at Harrison Ford. He's like 6'3".
Yeah. And
he's bigger than Rutger Hauer, and I think Rutger Hauer is like 6'2".
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
That's
Harrison Ford plays beat up real well.
Yeah.
Well, he did all of his. I mean. All of his stunts, all of his what he called physical work, he did it all himself for the most part, unless it was a true stunt.
That's great. Wake up. It's
and
time
see,
to
it's
die.
The eyes again. Oh!
Oh, my goodness.
And she just shot him in the head.
That is one of the nastiest effects I've ever seen.
It's awesome.
Now, there's your moral challenge. She's a replicant, and she killed a replicant to save a human.
That's right, because she loves him.
That's life right. Can get complicated.
Now, here, this is the one of the best touches
the blood
ever.
Going
look at
in.
This. He drinks it, and the blood comes out.
That's nice.
That's a nice touch.
That is.
It's all, and it's all that little detail.
From what I've heard, or maybe I heard it on one of the commentaries, they said that Harrison did that on purpose. He actually was putting the blood in there, and he suggested it.
That was his suggestion.
Oh, was it?
Choice.
Was it?
Very nice.
Oh,
yeah, very that's what, nice. You know, good actor moments. I love things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If he only
little touches much. For the reality. Again, embracing the darkness
not,
in this setup.
I'm not
in
the
scene.
Business.
And then the lights coming in from outside.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the world is intruding. The world is seeing everything in here.
You can never get away.
And it beats J.J. Abrams' flares. I'm sorry.
Off of that Star Trek? Yeah, the bridge and
well,
that Star Trek
not,
film
he's
was.
He's not necessarily flaring the
flare
camera.
Central.
He's, just, he's not flaring the lens. He's in this, the light's just coming across screen. It's
absolutely.
Just done really well.
Exactly. And it's not overdone.
Whoever did Fog Machine Smoke never had a moment's rest on this film.
Oh, no.
Good work, art department.
That was a lens flare. Sorry, JJ.
That's like three times in this one. That's interesting. What's great about this is it takes its time, and he's...
Well,
we're
cleaning
we're left
up,
alone with
and
her
we're
thoughts.
Left with her thoughts, exactly well, what she's thinking.
And also, right, because now everybody knows that she's a replicant, and now it's like, okay, what are we going to do?
Even she knows now.
Yeah, and he knows that she knows, and she knows that he
and
knows.
And she's escaped, and he knows
and
all the way. What's the next step?
And we see a gun on his hide, and we're like, this is your job to kill me, and what do I do now? I was really expecting that you have the under the water camera shot there.
Really?
Huey Lewis style?
Yeah.
I want a new drug.
Expect him to say, it's not the years, honey, it's the mileage.
Look at those. How does a DP even light their eyes that way? It just intrigues me so much.
Yeah.
And is that a, such to reconfirm her being a replicant?
Yes.
We always see her pupils that way.
Yes.
That's just the identification. Because
they do that with the owl and they do that. With,
yeah.
Now, I might
nice
be wrong,
little focus
but don't they
shift.
Do it later with Harrison as well?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Well, that's nothing subtle about that then.
Well,
they
but I, you know, the way that I take it is that it's suggesting that he's acting like a replicant. But, you know, in other words, he's not. He needs to be more human. He's not being human enough.
Oh, that's a nice interpretation. I like that.
Even though it's wrong,
I don't agree with it.
It's right.
Do you sort of see, Serge, the
parking lot, 3 o'clock?
But I hear you and I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
Serge, the correlation of a theme between this and 2001 of mankind losing touch with their humanity through the acceleration of technology?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
You could definitely dovetail
technology,
this with 2001's theme.
Technology, commercialism, the
I like the fact that there's nothing red in the whole room except for a lips.
Nice.
Like everything's dying or dead or drab.
You know, technology's just basically taken over this world to the point where they've gotten off world. You know, everything's polluted. I always like this part, actually, mm-hmm. where you don't see her,
mm-hmm.
and it's echoed throughout the apartment.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Do you think he really saw the inception date, or do you think he just is saying he didn't see it?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm thinking, too. He really knows when she's going to die.
Many places to go.
If I think it through.
And you know what? Here, look, it just went to handheld.
Mm.
Everything's been on dollies.
See, she's testing him right here. Have you ever taken it yourself?
Yeah. Well, exactly.
How do you know? How do you know I'm a replicant?
No, that's not about being a replicant. How have you ever tested on yourself as a human? You're not acting like a human being. You have to feel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
But you're right. I could see it
but
either
she's
way.
Challenging.
Yeah.
In like
to be a human. Be
I don't think she's really challenging him, saying, do you think she's challenging him, saying, are you could be a replicant too?
Well, I mean, how do you know my feelings are false?
Right, right.
Maybe yours are.
No, no, I'm taking it to mean that she's saying, you as a human, have you ever taken this test? Mm-hmm. Would you fail also? Because as a human, you fail to have emotions.
Once again, that's what makes this movie so fantastic, is you could have both opinions, not Surge.
I think Ridley Scott muddied it up by suggesting that whole thing, whatever.
Either way, it's genius.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
I like that Harrison Ford didn't wax his chest like most actors of today.
Yeah. Yes.
I know that might sound weird to say right here. But
no, I
mean, it's like, come on, it's real.
And
And
I was just going to admire her piano playing that she's now picked up.
I don't know about going to sleep with a shot of liquor on your belly, though. That doesn't seem like
I do it all the time.
I'm thinking something bad's just going to happen somewhere in the middle of the night.
You're a champion alcoholic.
Depends what you're drinking, I'm sure. How painful that could be.
Yeah.
This movie's so subtle, and this whole scene, and what makes it, and going back to Vangelis, what would this be like with any other type of score under it right here?
It was all of one. That's the whole thing. It all became one thing.
What's really interesting, she lets her hair down here.
Wait a minute. Oh.
Yes.
But I mean, it being more feminine, being more, of course. You know, as
well, she's letting go, and she's realizing who she really is now.
Right.
And
I mean,
and she's going to live.
I can do, exactly. I can finally spend these last days being who I wish I could be.
And again, look at her pupils. Look at that right, left pupil. It has that effect in there.
Yeah.
Is and that the bounce off the sheet music in front of her? But whatever it is, it's reinstating that theme. Yeah.
But now that she's at that realization, has she become more human? Because now the lipstick is gone, and she's now becoming more herself? Well, less plastic, less artificial?
Right. She feels that she is almost... should be human because she has the memories. She thinks she has the feelings, even though her affect, if you know, her affect is still flattened. Mm-hmm. But she feels like she thought she was a person up until now. She truly believed it.
Right. Or she's just, and I see that she's just accepting who she is.
Well, it's the existential disappointment of, like, I am not a human.
Is that
Largo?
Is that actually Largo she's playing?
I'm not familiar with the piece.
That's just what it said at the top of the sheet music.
Mm-hmm.
But what's neat is she's now her now.
She's
as opposed to she may not have been her back then, but what she's feeling and thinking and experiencing now is her.
Right, because she now knows she's found out her true nature, and she's finding or trying to find a way to accept. Well, this whole scene's about her accepting what she is, and then here he
is.
He's saying, "I can love you."
That's right.
It always
and then he gets a little.
And then she's like, "I don't
rough and tumble, huh? Look at this."
It always helps to know that
we don't see
Harrison and her did not get along well on this. Movie.
I've heard that, and I.
Like we don't see this nowadays, man.
I don't.
A little, you're not leaving type. I don't know. A little rough and tumble. Music changes very nicely.
It's a good scene.
Oh, yeah, it's fabulous.
It's an excellent scene. I mean, because they're both...
I think it's great.
They're both trying to deal with
me.
Their natures.
Well, it's also...
In the moment.
There was also natures and also what they think they should be...
And who they
are. As opposed to who they really are... And trying to let go of what we think we should be and what we should do and be in the moment
of who
we are.
And in some ways, I look at him as it as him trying to coach her out of her shell.
Yes.
And listen, that's why he says, kiss me.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's
and then
what
tell
I,
me that you
I'm
want
seeing.
Me, right.
That's the way I'm seeing this scene.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, in a way, mm-hmm. part of what his behavior is he's still, in a way, he's objectifying her still a little bit.
I don't think so.
There's a tiny bit of it.
No, I've had girlfriends where I have to say, just tell me that you want me.
Yeah.
Just kiss me. Like, don't think about your parents. Don't think about whatever.
Look, she takes the pill. I love that.
Do.
Take the pill.
There's our Pan Am reference.
Yes.
2001 plug for Pan Am in Blade Runner.
Here you go. Here's your wife.
There it is.
There.
That's what we were doing last night. A little face paint.
Okay.
Mix things up. What a trip.
Look at that old clock and the China doll down the side.
Does your wife look like Daryl Hannah?
She looks better than Daryl Hannah.
Does she move like Daryl Hannah?
Just yes.
Okay. I love just all the detail. You've got the one mannequin up there. She's mm-hmm. moving by the unicorn.
Oh, look, there's a unicorn. There's I didn't see that. I didn't see it.
Oh, you're all
going to
jump
it.
On that one.
And you got to like this like semi-robot person guy there. That's pretty trippy.
He's a watching.
It has a whole Island of the Forgotten Toys vibe to me.
There it is, yes, which had come previous to this. Now, have they gone into his story? I think he goes into his story here, right?
Yeah, that he's an imperfect. He's dying.
Well, he's got progeria, I think.
Yeah. So
look at her eyes.
Right. But that's why he likes building these things, is he wants to build something that actually works, and that's why he likes fixing things because of that reason. I think he might have already seen it, or did he?
And the whole thing with the eye thing reminds me of 2001 as well, with the front projection and what's reflected in the...
That's right, in the animals.
In the animals.
Animals' eyes.
The beginning scenes of 2001.
I always liked it right there when he said, "You're beautiful," and then his little robot looks over at him like...
He's like, yeah.
And in Blade Runner, would you say that the most passionate person would be Rutger Hauer's speech on the rooftop of embracing what it is to be alive and be human? But he's the replicant, and then 2001, Hal's the most human person.
Interesting.
Character.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you have artificial representing what is actually the most human of the story.
Which is the point is that you as humans watching this need to know to be more
human.
Human.
That's
and we're
right.
going to show you
what
how this works out. That's what makes this
Well, even in
great.
T2.
Well, yeah.
She has that whole thing at the end. If a machine can learn how to whatever, maybe we can too. You know, love or whatever she says about working together.
Wow.
See, I still look at this as both of them are still putting on an act. Like he's like, these are nice toys you have.
Oh,
and
yeah.
he's trying to egg him into, hey, come on, you can help us out.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Well, Sebastian, look at that.
They're dancing
Sebastian's
here.
Sebastian's great acting.
Doing the
he knows
dance.
He's over his head, man. He's like, oh, man. He realizes that's been set up.
You see the connection between those two. Look at that.
He's feeling like a third wheel.
That's right. He's like, oh, that's what I wanted to do with Briss. No, it's not going to happen.
I like how subtly through the rest of the scene, he still has that white makeup on his face. What attention to detail. So later in the scene.
Nice continuity.
There's 2 days later, they probably filmed that, and it's still there.
Look at that motion.
I know.
That's fabulous.
But he's, you know, I've heard Rutger Hauer speak about this, and he said that he was looking at Batty as a child. I mean, after all, he's four years old. Yeah, he's just a little kid.
Emotionally, he's four years old.
That's what I felt.
Physically,
with,
he's different.
With Decker and the last scene with Rachel, too. Mm-hmm. In a way, she is just a kid, and...
I love the old world look. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like Barry Lyndon or something.
Well, there was a big movement, I think, in the 19th century of building automata.
Oh.
In the UK, and I think somewhat in the United States and in Europe. And so a lot of these things, a lot of toys were made, actually, in the 18th and 19th century.
And I love how they, and by the way, I never was able to make it all the way through do Android's Dream of Electric Sheep because I thought I'd be getting Blade Runner, and I got about halfway through, and I was like, well. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is in that book or not, but I love how they use the chess piece, or they use the chess game, allowing them to come into the Tyrell Corporation and do that. It's really neat.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, I don't think it's in the book. I think that's something that Ridley Scott wanted to do.
It's all, the way he toys with him, he's like, "Yeah, I'm not."
Now he's like, "Okay, now."
And then when he tells him, he gets all excited. I knew it. Aha!
And see the way that actor just scratched himself right there. That's a trademark of his. I've seen him do that in all those Bob Newhart's. Really? That's a tick. Either he's planned or a tick, but he has that little mannerism.
And now she's much more like a lioness kind of coming around him. It's great.
Right.
She's becoming her real self now instead of being the fake.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was all about luring him in and getting in. It's just funny that Sebastian is so smart, yet he doesn't see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Does not see their motives. He doesn't have the social skills to even see through.
Well, I thought he felt. Well, you're right. Yeah, he feels screwed in some ways. But you're right. He doesn't see it. He hasn't put it together at all. Right.
He's not put it together at all. No. And this being a detective story, everyone else sees everything. Right. He doesn't.
Right. Because even him announcing that I work for the Torrell Corporation, he was excited. He's like, hey, we got something in common.
He's just trying to be a part of the group.
Yeah.
So in a way, he's less than human in that sense. Also, he's young. He's undeveloped in a way. He's got progeria. He's getting old. Yeah. He's super smart. But clearly, he doesn't interact with anyone else. I mean, he lives alone in this apartment. He doesn't deal with anyone.
He
doesn't have a substantial relationship of any sort, except with.
He's
Terrell.
Putting it together now.
Yeah,
he's like, I'm screwed. So this is page 75, which is where help comes from the universe or an unexpected person or an enemy that becomes a friend or the nice eye thing.
I always like that they cut back to the boiling eggs to show the heightened sense of the situation. Yeah.
And it's also great acting on his part. Look, he knows he's screwed, man. Mm-hmm. And even that little laughter before was like,
they thought they had him, but do we?
I got him. Cut to elevator scene.
And we get some light this time. Mm-hmm.
This is daytime in L.A.
A little hazy.
Well, from what I understand, not having been in Los Angeles back in the 80s, but it was pretty smoggy here, right? Mm-hmm.
60s and 70s, I heard, have just been were absolutely the worst.
And I think maybe that whole notion carried into this.
All the candles. Again, just very old world.
I just like that he's doing business in bed.
Sounds like Mother.
Actually, kind of sounds like Sean Young.
Mm. It's good makeup on that guy, on his name.
Terrell.
William Sanderson. No,
thank you, William Sanderson.
Larry.
Sebastian.
I also like Joe Turkel's glasses, how they're these big, thick, what do they call it, bottle glass?
Yeah.
Bottle cap?
The very thick ones, like he's got there.
Called bottle cap glasses.
Bottle cap glasses. Once again, emphasizing the eyes. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's the whole eyes in the window of the soul thing? Or
I think it's symbolism.
That's great lighting.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And then look how reserved he is about actually saying the next line.
Yeah, I know.
Like... Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to turn him over, but he knows he has to.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Check me out, I think.
And then look at, you know, Batty's like, you know you got to do this.
Yeah. Nice.
All the detail work in those miniatures. Look at all the grids and cross beams and lattice work, and I just love that.
There's the eye.
Absolutely.
And once again, going back to the old world feeling that you had I mean, in a way, the gods. Mm-hmm. So you'd have Tyrell, and you'd have essentially Sebastian, or the gods, or the creators. Mm-hmm. Say they live in an old world mm-hmm. setting, so to speak. Well, older world as opposed to film noirish mm-hmm. one. I think. I mean, it's a subtle mm-hmm. art deck cue. Yes.
Well, I also like the candles because the candles are real. Everything else is fake, but that's actually like real fire.
Are they?
I don't know. You know, now that I'm looking at it, I'm
that's
realizing
the question this film brings up about everything.
Well, no, they're moving. That one's moving.
Oh, they're real. Oh, yes.
But once again, there's that flickering of, like, you know, there's some giant fire behind him or some water effect.
Roy Batty's got to be the biggest badass in movie history. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Also,
you know, today if they remade Blade Runner, they'd put Dwayne Johnson or something in there.
Oh,
that's the Rock.
Oh, no.
Yes, they would. They wouldn't.
Oh. Like the eyes.
There's your line, sir. You called him
that's
fucker.
Right. He called him fucker.
Also on the Olympus, gods had the fire, and then somebody stole the fire and took it down.
Oh, that's a good mm-hmm. comparison.
I love this. I mean, like, see, what are they talking about? But you know exactly. I mean, it all makes sense.
What also? It's also like this almost has to take place in the sense that Roy has been thinking about all these options, and he wants logical explanations. How about this? How about this? How about this?
He wants to meet his creator. He wants to know, how will you stop me from dying?
That's right.
Yeah, he still had a sense of hope coming into this room.
Oh, yeah, he did. Yeah, he's pounding out the ideas.
But it's also the reason why he goes over the top. And
well, but that's he's come to find a solution.
I like that.
He's like, dude, that's no consolation.
Now this is in balance to Rachel's reaction to her. You know, at least finding her revelation that she's a replicant. He's now having to deal with, I am, you know, I'm screwed.
But he's got human feelings. He's actually, he's regretful that he did the things he did. No different than a man in battle as a human.
Yep. Yep.
But now he's saying, I'm going to take my wrath out on the universe. Well, almost.
If I'm going, I'm going to take everyone with me.
Exactly. And first I'm going to take it out of my god.
First, I'm going to kiss you because.
And first, I'm going to go gay.
here comes. Oh. He's always saying goodbye to the father, so he's kissing.
Well, he is,
kissing you goodbye. Well, here's the thing.
It's kiss of death. Yeah.
In the original version, he is Tyrell is a replicant, and they were going to have springs and things like that popping from his head,
really?
And whatnot, and they couldn't build it. And some people still believe that he's a replicant, and he's been dead for years. But they keep building replicants to take his place or take over the corporation. Right. So
now, actually, one difference there, and I think that was in the final cut, and it was also in the international cut, was you actually saw the fingers and the blood spurting out.
That's true.
And
I remember seeing gore.
Yeah,
I like not seeing it.
I'm okay with not seeing it.
I'm okay with not seeing it. When I saw it, I was like, ooh, okay.
I heard squishy Foley. That's all I needed to know.
Foley's great. Yeah. There's the stars receding.
God, I love this look.
The flick of the light.
Hello. Yeah, tucks his chin right here, watching. That's awesome. What a reaction.
He's
definitely made a decision.
What a reaction. It's like, okay. But anyway.
Now, this is great. When Decker calls and Priss picks up, Priss actually probably thought it was Roy calling after this.
Now, this is the Warner backlot, right, Curtis?
Yes, this is. This is that down there is Stephen J. Ross.
Ah, that's the Stephen J. Ross Theater, the far end of the street.
That neon blue.
So this is where he finds out that Sebastian was also found dead. So now he's going to call Sebastian's place.
I like it. Right here, his badge number is, he says Deckard 26354. Listen, he'll give his badge number. Watch. That's one of my email addresses.
Oh, really?
Deckard 26354. That's how big of a dork I am. I won't give you the rest of it, so I won't get emailed.
You are a dork. Right.
Deckard 26354.
Ah.
Because it shows how big of a dork you are, because it's not even easy to remember.
Yeah, it's not. It is for me.
26354.
It is for me.
Let's see how long I remember that.
Yeah. But that's his old friend of JS.
Yeah.
Old friend of JS.
Old friend. Old friend.
That's not very friendly. There's no way to treat a friend. I think we should do one whole movie where we just repeat dialogue the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that. There. Got to keep moving in L.A., I'm telling you. Right. Don't want any grass growing under you.
They don't even wait for you to stop.
Boy, they look like Ewoks or Jawas. Jawas, yeah. They reminded me of the Jawas.
Well, I actually had a thought that to have a good size, good successful, long-lasting science fiction film, you need to have little people in it. in some way, just because, I don't know, it just...
I'm seeing a lot of similarity in effects to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm. When you see ships flying over, you have that little ring of light around whatever lights are on the ship, and you have that smoke effect. Mm-hmm. Those are lifted right out of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Doug Trumbull, same style.
Trumbull did both, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And very similar.
Million-dollar movie. I like your Was it? Did you call it midget, dwarf, little person theory?
Mm-hmm.
In order to have
a successful, long-lasting
go through.
Oh,
the new Star Trek has
a short person. As a short person.
Yeah, he was the little.
Damn, you're right.
Sidekick of.
I don't know why.
You're right. What short people like?
Take a half a second to gander at this Bradbury building right here.
Yeah.
And look at the lighting detail and the set design. Mm-hmm. And appreciate it. And then when he's going up the staircase here in a minute, I mean, I'm sure anybody that's a fan of this film, I don't have to say that, but it's, take a pause. It's ridiculous.
Oh, what they did is incredible. I remember, once again, you look up and you see that.
And there's our source of all the shafts of light always moving in rooms.
Right.
And the music.
And here we go, cutting to this.
The music is sourced. I saw an episode of ER, and in one episode where George Clooney goes to visit some patient, mm-hmm. and they shot at the Bradbury for one shot. I'm like, mm-hmm. whoa. Mm-hmm.
So, Serge, when you say the music is sourced, what does that mean?
What I'm saying is that also the music is motivated by the dirigible.
Right. The Asian woman singing, right.
I see.
Yeah.
Well, for
that part of it. That's short part of it.
For the people that want to go.
What I just appreciate about this is just it takes its time. I mean, it's not like he's up there in like 3-4 shots and the camera moves unmotivated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But for those people that want to go see the Bradbury Building in its full light, it's also in the movie Disclosure, I believe it is, with Demi Moore.
Oh.
I mean, all of their offices are in it. And that's really what they are. If you go to visit the Bradbury Building, which I have, I won't. Mm-hmm. They are offices. That's what they are.
You did your Blade Runner tour?
Yeah.
Is that named after Ray Bradbury?
Your unofficial Blade Runner. No. The unofficial Blade Runner tour.
That would be funny.
That'd be cool if you have the sci-fi Bradbury building and Blade Runner. That's okay.
I've seen him talk. If you guys ever get a chance to see him talk.
Ray Bradbury?
Phenomenal.
I sat next to Ray Bradbury.
Inspiring and enthusiastic. It's just Fahrenheit. It's incredible. That's my two cents on him if you get a chance.
I just want to talk just a few moments here because we haven't gotten to this yet and I want to get this in, is that Blade Runner was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, art direction and visual effects, not music, mind you, just so you know. And it's like, who knows, science fiction, the early 80s, I don't know how seriously it was taken, but I mean, definitely it deserved a costume design, I think, probably deserved it too, but it didn't get that.
Sure.
Anyway.
What won, Serge?
Well, visual effects... beaten out by E.T. In that category was Poltergeist, E.T., and Blade Runner for the visual effects.
Yeah, that was a real big science fiction year, huh?
It was a big science fiction year. And then for art direction, Gandhi. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gandhi.
And music instead of Vangelis.
Let's put him on a road.
It was John Williams for E.T.
It was John Williams for E.T.? Yeah.
Well, that brings up a point of, I believe...
Wasn't even nominated for music.
Ah.
Yeah.
I think it was Ridley Scott or somebody else or other people's theories that that's one reason this movie kind of got overlooked during that time was because of that year having so many sci-fi films. And then this kind of came out of left field as being so much different. Nobody really got it.
Well, not only that, but E.T.
Oh, E.T. was huge.
Because E.T. kind of changed the whole mood. I mean, because you had Poltergeist was a darker mood, Star Trek.
And this
and then
is
E.T.
dark.
Made everything very light. Mm-hmm. This is a... Look at her hair. Love
well,
it.
Gentlemen, let's not forget 1982 is the year The Thing came out as well.
Oh, yes. The Thing.
If you want to go dark sci-fi, something that was overlooked, they released The Thing in summer. And that was a winter, arctic, dark film.
Yeah.
One of my favorite sci-fi films.
Yeah. The Thing?
This and The Thing.
Because we're dark people.
So 1982, Blade Runner and The Thing.
This death scene is so brutal.
It is so brutal.
Daryl, we needed to thrash some more. Come on.
They said that she was so battered and bruised after this day of shooting because she really was just pounding away.
Yeah.
And actually, in the final cut, she's shot twice. But once again, I think
once
was fine.
It goes longer.
It does go longer.
It seems like it goes for at least another minute longer. Which is great because it really makes it show you how brutal it is.
Well, and he's not shooting a pea shooter. He's shooting a replicate killer. Right. He's got that gun. It's like a kid.
He's like a Sandman.
You know what the line was supposed to be?
Mr. Sandman.
What's that?
The line that he was supposed to say was, "You're retired."
No.
I'm going to throw you a retirement party. Here's a gold watch. Bam.
Well, here's your gold watch.
I got your gold watch right here. Nice move. God. Let's crane up.
Actually, he was going to say Medicare's not going to take care of that.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm trying to put the pieces back together. So the whole fight scene is in this building.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I didn't remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came back.
The location of
that. Yeah, Harrison got here before Roy did.
Right. I mean, this is just...
I think he's not going to be happy.
Well, it's not that he's not happy. It's just that everything he's had, he loved Pris.
In his twisted way.
In his twisted way. And she was the last of his bunch. Everyone else is dead.
Mm. Nice hand makeup.
Exactly what I was going to say.
And the tongue sticking out is just
very...
She's a sad clown. She's crying on the inside.
Oh.
We didn't mean to start, Tim.
Yeah. You know, I think actually in other versions, he dips his fingers. Oh, no, that's in a second. That's right. I'm sorry.
Hmm. Great lighting.
Here we have shafts of light and fog machine overkill.
Oh, the water on the wall. I'm like,
a leaky building.
That's a really nice shot.
Yeah, really.
It's very motivated. It's very motivated.
This style reminds me of James Cameron. Whenever he gets intense, you have the shafts of light, and if you notice in James Cameron's films, sharp focus, intense close-up, shafts of light all over the place. Mm-hmm. Same kinetic style.
Painful. Yes.
Why doesn't he? I don't get why doesn't he not kill him? I mean, it's so interesting.
Well, he's just a cat playing with a mouse.
Yeah,
he's right.
Is it the whole thing about living in fear?
I like how they also showed it.
That he did shoot his ear.
That
was pretty damn close.
So, John, what do you mean living in fear?
Well, that's what Leon said, and that's what the other person said. They're all about being a slave and living in fear stinks. Mm-hmm. How do you like living in fear? Mm-hmm. And now this is what he gets to do.
Oh,
he
so he's turning the tables
fear.
On Deckard to live in fear.
But living in fear, but also with some physical incapacitation. In other words, you may think you have the gun, but now I'm going to take away your ability to actually work that tool.
Right.
Yeah, there's the blood. I mean, here he's being more human than Deckard can be.
Yep. You know, I'm just thinking, if I ever stumble upon someone that I really love who's dead, I'm not going to put their blood on my face. You know?
Note to self. Okay.
But notice what he's doing. He's an animal. I mean, he's basically reverting to his animal nature. Mm-hmm. He's getting as primal and as primitive as possible.
War paint. Maybe that's war paint?
There you
no,
go.
No, I mean, it's blood. He's...
I mean, symbolizing, what would you say?
No, it wasn't even just in terms of in terms of feeling her blood, putting it on his face. It doesn't make a difference to him anymore. He's dying. Everything has become very elemental to him.
Well, it's also a great way to strike fear into the heart of someone when you start howling. When someone who's chasing you starts howling, it doesn't make you like smile and feel good about yourself.
When I howl after people, let me tell you, they go running. Yeah,
like holy.
Or go singing.
Or singing opera or Italian, some bad... that wow. stuff is like
I don't
spooky.
Know which is scarier.
It's like, oh,
the howling or...
That's right.
Okay, obviously he's testing him. Who's going to stay alive? Now, why in God's name, I want to understand...
Did he take off his clothes?
No, not him. Why does he climb this thing? Can't he just find some stairs, go upstairs? I mean, what's the deal?
Yeah, it's a plot device. Let's get him outside.
Well, I mean,
no, let's have him climb the wall.
Well, the windows were closed. I totally agreed with you, Serge, when I saw the movie numerous times. I'm like, what an awkward thing to try and climb when someone's chasing you. That's like my nightmares are made of that kind of stuff. I'm like,
well, but that's good. Maybe that's what it is. It is nightmare imagery.
It does have a nightmare
feel.
Trying
to climb a bookcase while someone's chasing you with broken fingers and
now he's
God.
On the roof and it's raining.
And this is very Gotham to me.
Yeah.
Well,
this is like out of a Batman
this
film.
Is him being
I thought
reborn.
You were gonna say Gothic, but it is.
Gothic and Gotham.
Yeah,
Gotham
exactly.
City.
Him coming through that hole, couldn't you argue that, also that it's him being reborn?
Ooh. Interesting.
Deckard being reborn?
Well, he's come to a realization of what the world's really about, who he really is.
Right, do the birth canal. Wow.
Okay, all right, that's good imagery.
Curtis, what do you think about
it? But also, look at the hands. Now, the imagery of the hands, how they've tied it together with the editing. And, of course, there is other imagery there, too, I know.
I like that. Point, Curtis.
In terms of the hand.
Now, symbolism there?
The Christ imagery, I would assume. But I don't know.
But also, just on a elemental level, he's fighting the pain, I guess, you know, that's taking his life away at the moment. The pain of death.
He's trying to create some type of adrenaline rush that will reinvigorate him and allow him to finish this one last task or stay longer, just that much longer. Stay alive that much longer, excuse me.
Right. I mean, he's playing Predator.
Oh man, that's a nice smack.
That's the year he made contact.
See, now he wants him to fight like
wants him to fight for his life.
Fight with his hands.
Wait, did this
with
turn
gun.
Into a John Woo? Movie.
I was waiting for the doves. I'm waiting for the doves.
No. John Woo came after.
I know. Thank you, Serge. Thank you. Serge.
Beautiful paintings through here.
Yeah,
it's just beautiful work. Is this Albert Whitlock? Do we know?
No.
Who did the?
I think it's
Is it old school? Like
it's,
Albert
it's
Whitlock?
Richard. It's
Urich.
I think Jurisic.
I always pronounce it Urich. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, if that's how it's pronounced.
I've never heard it pronounced. I've only read it on the credits.
Yeah, I think he worked on this.
Did you see the entire wall just move? Seriously, the wall of the set went back and forth of the bricks.
You know, thankfully, I missed it.
I love just how Rutger plays this scene where he...
Yes, I agree.
Here in a second when he leans up, looks at the rain, sticks his head up, closes his eyes, and then he pulls his head back in. It's just so well done.
Oh, yeah.
Where are you going?
Do we know if Rutger Hauer's speech on the roof was came as they were shooting, or was it locked in script-wise?
It was a combination of things. A lot of it was written. It was cut down. Then he added a few things.
Well, I heard
a few things?
Well, there was a lot
Rutger
longer
Hauer.
Poem, and from what my understanding is, and I could be very, very wrong on this, was that he came in and said, can we distill it down to this and make it a lot smaller?
Yeah, they wanted to cut it down.
And then, but he came up with from what I thought, he came up with that final line, though.
The one about tears in the rain. That's his.
That yes, that's not.
Also, apparently, he came up with a thing with a dove.
Yeah, where he's holding it. Correct. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's, if I remember right. For those people that are, you know, another pop culture little craziness here. I mean, mm-hmm. the DP Jordan Cronenwith, his mm-hmm. son did Fight Club, Jeff Cronenwith, mm. and he's a very well known DP now.
Oh,
mm-hmm. so and he might have done Seven too, I believe.
And Curtis, no, did
and
you
I
mention
think wasn't Seven Darius Kanji?
You might be right. I'm just guessing. I think he worked with Fincher a few times, so but I could yeah. be very wrong. But I do know he did Fight Club.
And you said, had you said apparently that this DP on Blade Runner was sick at the time of filming?
Yeah, he was not well. He was very he was not well, and it usually later in life died from whatever disease he had during this.
Do we know how much later was it? A few?
He died in 96.
Yeah, uh-huh. But it was quite a bit longer. But he was even ill during this time.
That's a shame.
And believe mm-hmm. you me, if I'm wrong, somebody call me. Deckard 26354.
That's right.
Because I never claim to be fully right. Sometimes my memories right. clutter together on things I've heard and what are actually true.
It just makes me wonder if James Cameron watched this sequence and the lighting through this film and applied it towards Aliens mm-hmm. and Terminator. Mm-hmm. Things rotating, you got your fog, shafts of light. It just conjures all that up in my mind as I watch it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if this is just some story that goes around this whole scene that they like to talk about to make Rutger Hauer seem greater and more romantic of a story about this scene. But when they were shooting this scene, of course, that scene right there where you saw Harrison Ford's stuntman jump across that right. ledge and from building to building, you mm-hmm. know, he didn't make it because it's a far leap and he had to go and make it across that leap. And right. supposedly, well, Rutger Hauer's character is supposed to just be able to have this superhuman strength and right. bounce right across. His stuntman couldn't make it.
Oh.
And kept failing on making it. And Rutger Hauer said, hey, I think I can make it. Let's just try it one time. And turns around. And they do this. Because it's like 15 feet off the ground. It's not, you know, hundreds of feet. And it one shot jumps right across.
Really?
And that's the story. So that's one
So you're saying that long shot is Rutger Hauer?
That's
shot
no,
from
they,
below?
You saw him.
No,
that,
cut.
No, no, no. That scene shots. Right there where he turns around and jumps.
Yeah, but
yeah,
they
there
cut.
Two separate shots. They yeah. did cut, but he did make the jump.
He jumped across.
So my question is, that's him
he,
and
he
both
made the
shots.
He made the jump across. Yeah, because you saw him. He turned around, and then he started jumping off, and then they cut to the...
It's that whole fear thing.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice shot hanging off the...
What a
building.
What a great matte painting.
Hmm. And he had some movement in there, a car or something down below. It was great.
Now, technically, that nail would, of course, be going into Deckard's hand, but I'll ignore that.
A little bit, yes, it would be.
Ouch.
But, it, yeah. It would,
at this
yeah.
point, he's like, I don't care.
Yeah, exactly. You're saving my life. You can poke me in the wrists a little bit with your iron nail thing.
Right.
And as from actor's point of view, mm-hmm. just got to love those scenes where it's all this rain.
Yeah.
Can you imagine shooting this?
It's being always all that, wet.
I wonder what the temperature of the water hours. Was. Oh. Do they actually heat the water a little bit before it goes through the pipes and hits you? Or is it just cold?
And of course, Harrison Ford's like, why did you just do that? It's crazy. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
My yeah. favorite scene right here right. out of the film. This is my favorite scene. Mm-hmm.
Now listen to what he's talking about, mm-hmm. how amazing it looks. And think back to the beginning of the film when we first saw
mm-hmm.
our view, the world that we were introduced to.
And for my money, every it's human nice. Has said this speech.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every person comes to this at some point.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's such a revelation for him as a character development because people forget sometimes when watching this film that he was built as a replicant killer. He's not built as a normal human being or mm-hmm. a normal human replicant. Mm-hmm. So that's why the four of them had the superhuman powers And he was never more human than that moment right there, where that's why he saved him. He realized.
Just that shot that we just saw, that was actually a pickup that they did in England.
The bird flying away.
The bird flying with the blue sky, which, of course, they changed in the final cut to have a darker sky. I mean, it was always kind of odd, but I just kind of went with it. And I like the juxtaposition of the dissolve between them, essentially two sides.
And we have a tremendous amount of light right there. Yeah. Oh, because time has passed. Now we have the arrival behind him.
A few minutes, yeah.
Because it looks almost as if it's sunlight.
I think the implication is that... Oh, no, they were running it. They were running out of time. They were shooting all night. That actually was at dawn where they shot that shot.
Because that shot matches with the bird flying away if you're going to have light starting to appear. That's the only reason why I brought it up.
I love Gaff's line right here. Mm-hmm. It's so prophetic.
Now, what would the difference between through and finished be? I guess you're through. Finished. There's a... He said that for a reason.
Yeah. Through could mean you're dead. You're through.
Or you're done killing replicants. Or are you?
Finished means I'm quitting.
And you're quitting. Yeah. Well, because that's all...
Here you go.
That's great. That's a good line.
Awesome. Who really does that?
Dying is easy. So not everyone lives. Not
exactly. All right.
So that is the whole... That's the whole coaching line that always happens. How about always? It happens a heck of a lot in where hero tries to do things the old way, and then finally at the end, somebody reminds him, like Trinity said to Neo, I love you, get up, you're the one. And he's saying, everybody dies. And then he just... It totally snaps for him. Okay, I'm with her. Yes. You're right. It doesn't matter.
So you're saying Trinity and Neo out of the Matrix?
Yes, and Trinity's coaching Neo, and Gaff just coached, Deckard, giving him the final go ahead to make the full transformation.
Yeah,
right. To complete the arc, right? To.
What's such a dramatic setup and taking your time? Where is she?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is she dead?
And then, there's a sheet. What's in the sheet?
And what are those screens showing? That's the thing. It's just.
I don't really. It's like, it's great. I don't really care. It's futuristic, man.
Again, style over logic. It's
the future.
Or is he going to kill her? That's the thing.
I'm trying to remember how I felt, actually, there, of course, you're thinking you don't know what's going to happen.
I mean, the gun's not even...
Well, actually, my thought was that she's dead already, that Gaff had gotten her or someone had gotten her.
Or maybe she had died.
I hadn't thought of that. I thought someone had gotten her. And then, of course, we get our...
No, it was a wonderful sort of misleading... Implication of his gun going down, you think it's going to point towards her, but then it's turning away just to lift the sheet.
Well, even the music didn't kick in.
Putting you in doubt at all times.
And it was nice, the music didn't even kick in to give us a clue that she was alive. They waited for him to have the emotion that he knew that she was
very
alive.
Nice. It didn't spoon feed us.
See, that's interesting here. He's just going back to what you were saying. He's basically told her, what to say. I love you. I love you. I trust you. I trust you. Yeah. He's teaching her.
Yeah.
I love the sound of the wind out on the balcony. It's great.
And she certainly doesn't look as uptight as she did before.
Yeah.
There we have our origami unicorn on the floor.
And he notices because he knows Gaff was there.
Yeah.
And so he knows Gaff could have...
Yep.
Gaff was human.
Yeah.
Gaff did not kill her. He didn't do anything.
And now this is the biggest realization for him. Is there you go.
He even nods his head.
Is that dialogue in the final cut or no?
Yeah, it is. No, it is now.
No, the voiceover.
Or is that?
Yes, Gaff.
I'm sorry, you're right. That is.
Yes,
right.
That was. Serge is correct. Yeah, this is before it, and they would do that, and they would close on the elevator doors closing. This is how it ended.
Right, and it's still ending. Final cut. Right.
This is theatrical cut.
And if you're watching Final Cut, what we're watching is Deckard riding in a car with
Rachel.
Oh. The voiceover says,
yeah, you don't get that if the voiceover's not there.
Harrison says Rachel was special, that there was no termination date. I don't know
how much time we have, but who does?
Do you know where they stole this scene from? Do you know where they stole this footage from?
Little House on Prairie.
They didn't steal the footage. No, what they did is they contacted Kubrick's production company that had footage from The Shining, and they used this footage for the end. And that's, I don't know. I mean, that's perfectly fine by me.
You take footage that wasn't used in a Kubrick film, you could make 18 films, probably.
So it's pronounced Richard.
Jurisich.
I'm
assuming. David Dreyer was the supervisor. So
Sid Mead also did 2010.
All the conceptualization for that. Sid Mead, wait, didn't he work on Star Wars, Sid Mead?
I'm not aware of that. I do know 2010. He did a wonderful job on that.
Ralph McQuarrie worked on Star Wars.
I know he did conceptual art. Ralph McQuarrie.
Right. So... Anyway, I'm going to actually ask...
kicks into high gear.
I'm going to ask Tim, since Tim's never seen this version, what'd you think?
I liked it. It wasn't as radical as I thought in being different.
And it's not as overwrought, as much narration as people make it out to be. There's really only a few narration scenes in the movie.
Yeah, it's not that much. It's the beginning and it's the end.
I've heard so much about how radically, from one to the next, and it wasn't as jarring as I thought it would be at all. Right.
And what about the end? What do you think of the end?
I like the ending from the latest version, 2007. What is that one called again?
Final Cut.
Thank you. Final Cut. I like the ending of that one.
So you didn't need to see them driving in the car and being happy?
Yeah. Nope, I don't need that. For film noir? No, I don't.
Right. Gotcha. Totally.
And also, I liked the Final Cut. It just goes right to black. The music kicks in and you're... Mm-hmm. Instead of all the pretty, beautiful trees and outdoor nature and everything. To me, dark. Film noir. I'll stick with that.
Curtis?
I am not a fan of either. I mean, I'm a fan of both, I should say. I'm not a hater of one or the other. I can appreciate both of them equally. So being that this is the original theatrical cut, I like rewatching it again and seeing it the way I saw it whenever I was younger. But the newer stuff, and maybe it's because I'm such a fan that of this one, it made me understand the other one more, maybe. But I love them both equally. I have no prejudice toward one or the other. But he is a replicant.
Final word.
Deckard is a replicant.
Guess who's your final answer? Guess who's going to speak last? And you guys are still you guys are still have. I mean, watching it again, still have same. I mean, I guess you guys just watched it a couple years ago.
Yeah, so. I mean, but you know what, Blade Runner to me is literally a movie that I will put on in the background if I'm cleaning house. Mm-hmm. And contrary to what my wife thinks, I actually do. Clean house, but I put on Blade Runner in the back, or if I'm writing, or if I'm doing.
And we have your wife right here.
That's right.
She's going to chime in.
Hi, yes.
But anyway, so I put it on all the time. So
okay, John,
the Burbank Studios.
Yeah, I totally get the idea that the I actually kind of like not seeing the happy ending at the end. It shifts gears a little too big, and I got the point that. Nobody knows when they're going to die. I don't know if I really needed to hear that the third time, 2 minutes later after I just heard it saying gaff. But I loved it. I wish they would have kept the, in the final cut version, I wish they would have kept that, the unicorn dream image, whatever. Cause then I really think that helps my argument or my thought that he is a replicant. So, and that gaff knew his innermost thoughts and dreams, just like
he knew the spider story with
exactly.
her.
Exactly.
He's like, well, I know your unicorn story.
That's right. Yep. And I'm letting you go. Yep. Exactly.
May I just say that my favorite science fiction films are the ones that promote wonderful ideas. Mm-hmm. you know, among more than anything else. And to me, that's what Blade Runner does. I love the idea it just proposes for everyone to ponder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll still go back to, you know, when I saw this back in 1982, it was just bold. Or, you know, I think I'd seen E.T. and Poltergeist and Star Trek already, and I saw this, and I'm like, wow, this is fantastic. And to the point where I saw it multiple times when it came out on videotape, I watched it again. I studied it, wrote a paper on it and body heat and film noir and all that kind of thing. And to that extent, I was fine with the voiceover and the ending. And when it was taken out, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, we don't need the voiceover. I mean, I could go for more of, I'd like the voiceover to be out, and we don't need the ending. And then when the idea was floated about him being replicant, I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's a really cool idea. But I've since kind of retreated to, I mean, I can go for what I'll call the art house cut, which is no narration and none of that. But I can still go back to this and go, I can see the flow of that quote-unquote happy ending to just give a bit more of the release that was needed at the end, which it had led to. And that, with the imagery and
the voiceover. Trees and stuff?
With the trees and then mm-hmm. seeing the car. And mm-hmm. they were shot very well from within. Yeah. We never saw the actual car, but we just, you know, we saw is like essentially point of view.
Right.
And it puts it in our mind that they're essentially escaping. But we know that there's really no escape in this world. They're going out to the country. What is there in the country? They're going away from civilization. There really is no escape for them. There is not going to be a happy ending, but at least for this moment, in their hearts, it's like almost in their hearts they have the happy ending.
Well, it's all symbolism,
too. And they can see, which is this
film. The first time we ever saw light in the whole film is at the end, whenever they're getting...
Basically, yeah. I mean, that's sunshine. So in that sense, I'm perfectly fine with this cut of it. You know, mm-hmm. I'll accept the other ones, but that's just my feeling. And also the whole thing about him being human for me is kind of important because... It's about, you know, we're humans, we go to the movies, so we have to have some character to sympathize with, at least I believe, or at least to see it through. And so it's about his, for me, it's about his needing to be human, because he's hardly human. Mm. And everyone else is more human, so it teaches him that lesson, so maybe someday before he dies he'll figure out, that's what it is to be human.
Can I ask you a question? Are you going to put you're going to scan your paper and put it on the website?
Oh, it's not that good.
Your Blade Runner?
I don't even know where it is.
Oh, man.
No,
cool.
Not worth it. But I was examining essentially noir techniques or just use of noir in films, that body heat and whatever else. So,
you know, that brings up, as far as the different endings to the film, am I wrong? I don't think I saw the original, but Payback? The ending where he's riding off with the girl, and you know that it's bleak, but for the moment they think that they've got it, a happy story, but it can't lead to that. That reminded me of the ending of this. Mm. Now, was that original ending, was that a new ending to Payback? The Mel Gibson movie.
They went back. Oh, yes, there's Payback and there's Payback.
Director's
what's
Cut.
It called? No, it's not. Well, it's called Payback Straight Up, where Helgeland went back in, recut the negative.
It was from all the footage they originally shot.
They originally did that and they rescored it, and the whole third act is different.
So that's my question. So the original, it ends completely different from... The recut.
But he still goes off with the girl, though.
So my question is, it similar to this?
No, it could be happy,
but it's actually not a happy ending?
No. Payback Straight Up is a much more drastic change from Payback, the regular movie.
The original Payback theatrical release is much more different. The one we get to see, the director's cut, is an actual, that's how it was shot. The studio went back and paid for them to go back and reshoot the whole Kris Kristofferson stuff, everything. That whole scene wasn't there. But I think this doesn't need to be.
But in relation to this, what are you asking?
So what I'm asking is it comparable to this of one cut? You have him leaving with her and driving out, and it seems like a happy ending.
He still leaves with
the girl. But in Payback, he leaves with the girl both times at the end?
Well, I guess we're going to have to do Payback Straight Up, perhaps.
There you go.
Anyway, it just came to my mind that the ending could be look like a happy ending, but actually where they're driving to is a very sad destination. That, to me, was the ending of the most recent Payback that came out that I saw, the original director's cut.
Right.
It just came to my mind, thought I'd voice it.
Yep. So, it's interesting. I mean, taking something and, I mean, they've definitely had, I mean, this is such a seminal film that it did inspire in a way, so many different little versions, and that people would actually still want to watch them. I still want to watch, actually, in the 5-disc set, I have the 4-disc, but there's the work print, which was the one that was shown in Dallas and Denver. I want to see that because I want to see what's different in there. So that's still my interest. I still think this is one of the greatest science fiction films ever, not surpassing 2001, but I still think it gives it definitely a run for its money.
It's iconic.
Okay.
Science fiction, Topper, we like it.
Yeah, good times.
E.T.? E.T. perhaps? No. Okay, never mind. All right, quickly, structure. How this all work for structure?
Great. And fantastic. I'm structured out at the moment. I don't really want to go through the whole thing again. But that was great. No, it's right there. Yeah. It was fabulous, and it was great, and it was great to see, you know, the classic scenes where, you know, Brian just comes back and says, you know, the midpoint is so solidly obvious. Oh no, you got one more to kill. I mean, that's and the whole arc of him developing the relationship is fabulous. So good times. And if anybody wants to learn more, they can stop by structurenotformula.com and say hello.
Cool. All right. So this is Serge Dalpierre bidding you adieu. To my right,
John H. Ruby.
To my left,
Tim McMillan.
And Curtis Nelson.
And he was to his left, too. Thank you very much for this Film Grok. See you next time.